got to be honest, and I think about this often, with my two-year-old when she holds her breath because she didn't get her way, I know eventually she's going to take a breath. Eventually, at some point, it's going to happen. She's going to cave. That's how the Republicans look at the Democratic Party. They know eventually if they hold out long enough, if they hold off down the road long enough and enough pain and suffering is on the horizon or imminent death, that the Democrats will cave. Just like my two-year-old has to breathe. She's not going to be able to hold her breath long enough to kill herself. But I think Republicans, I think they would. I think they have that kind of mentality that they really, really don't care about the country. They care about themselves and their policy and their folks. And you got to give them credit for that. You got to give them credit for that. In the second hour, we're going to talk with John Logan, Director of Labor and Employment Studies at San Francisco State University. He's written a good piece, Worse Than Obamacare, Conservatives Demonize the NLRB. Today, big hearing, which I thought was kind of hysterical. They brought in a Bush NLRB member. They brought in a union-busting attorney from Jackson Lewis. They brought in a poor small business owner, some dolt of an employee who was, you know, propped up by the National Right to Work Committee, and one pro-labor guy who was fantastic. And we're going to have him on the program tomorrow night because, you know, look, you got to have – maybe that's the division in the country. Maybe it is 4-1. Maybe there's only one voice out there in the wilderness standing up for working people. But we'll be talking to him tomorrow night. Also tonight on the program, Deanne McQueen, Vice President of the National Nurses Union, not happy about the president's, what I'm calling blink. Some people are saying, well, you know, it could be a shrewd move, or it could be just caving. Or it could be just, congratulations, Mr. President, you just made your reelection campaign that much harder. You've just made this whole game that much harder. Democrats have so much more to defend. More Senate seats, more governor's seats, and of course the White House. And I keep looking at this and going, this, my friend, is not solidifying the base. This is not encouraging the base. Now, the Republican spin machine, they have been working overtime. They have been doing, you got to give them credit. They're doing a fabulous job. And what they're working on is they're trying to say, well, you know, we shouldn't tax those rich people. We're a classless society. There are no classes here. You could be rich one day, and then you might have to pay those taxes. It's those people, those poor people, who don't pay any federal taxes. They're the ones. We should go after them. And I go, well, wait a second. They don't have any money. They're poor, remember? They're in poverty. They can barely put food on the table. Those are the people we're going to go after to fix our debt. But we're going to continue to give away the huge subsidies to the CEOs and their jets and to the oil companies and to, you know, the little private islands. We're going to keep doing that stuff. But you got to give them credit. They are doing a fantastic job of spinning. But, you know, to be honest, the Democrats don't seem to be doing themselves much good, and they seem to be helping the Republicans. Like this evening, after the president came out and said, you know what, we're going to put Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid on the table. Huge victory for the Republicans, no matter how you want to slice it. Huge victory. 70 plus years in the making. This today is the wet dream that every Republican has had in their entire existence. How do we get them to chop down Medicare? How do we get them to chop down Social Security? How do we finish off that New Deal? How do we finish off that safety net? How do we put those working people at our mercy? That's what they've done. But here's what the DCCC did today. I beat up on everybody when they deserve it. The Democrats in this deserve it. They sent out a fundraising email, and I got to just read it. Our producer got it. It says, I need your urgent help, writes the guy from the DCCC. Republicans are gearing up to enact their radical plan to balance the budget on the backs of seniors, women, and people with disabilities. At this moment, Speaker Boehner is crafting a deficit deal that would gut Medicare and Social Security while slashing benefits for seniors and the middle class in order to make sure he protects tax breaks for millionaires. This is unacceptable, and House Democrats will not stand for this. I'm sorry. Did I not hear it right? Maybe I got something in my ear. It was the president who put Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid on the table. Something that I didn't think a Democrat would do. And what the Republicans have been really good at is pointing back to those poor people and saying, you know what? They're not paying anything. At a time when we live in a country where 400 people have more wealth than half of the nation. Half! So what are you going to get from half? You get the same from the same 400 people that you get from half of the country. But we're not talking about those 400 people. We're only talking about the bottom half. We're going to take their Social Security. We're going to take the Medicare. We're going to take the Medicaid. You know, we live in a society where half the children in this country are dependent on food stamps. Half. And yet we want to take more from that. We want to destroy those programs even more. Somehow it doesn't make any sense to me. And I know, you know, some people are going to say, well, you know, the president's, you know, playing a, you know, this is a shrewd game of poker. And I hope you're right. I hope the guy is the best poker player in the world because he's got me fooled. But you know what? The Democrats are going to find, and Obama are going to find considerable resistance to this. Because I don't know many people who are going to say, yeah, okay, you know, Granny's, you know, she's subsiding. And in the future, you know, I'm going to look back at her and I'm going to go, boy, she had it good, because you're going to recalculate how my Social Security works. So I'm in poverty. Understand, Social Security was an anti-poverty program. We're going to recalculate it away from inflation down to the consumer price index, which is kind of what they're nobody's sure, but it's kind of the direction that they're going, so that inflation will then eat it all away. And what bothers me, is this whole debt ceiling thing. It has turned into who can we screw, who can we stick it to, who can we steal from. And I look at former National Security Advisor Dr. Zbigniew Brzezinski. Yesterday he was on TV discussing how we have this vast income disparity, how we have this huge gulf between the 400 who have and the 150 million who have the same, and how this could, you know, this could lead to some civil unrest. Maybe, like I've been saying for the longest time, maybe at some point people's stomachs get empty and their heads get right and they start taking to the street. So he basically reiterates what I've been saying all along, that if the middle class starts suffering and suffering severely, we could see people taking to the street. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure this stuff out. And he's pretty clear about it. He says, look, I don't want to be a prophet of doom. I don't think we're approaching doom, but I think we're going to slide into intensified social conflicts, social hostility, some form of radicalism. There is just going to be a sense that this is not a just society. And he added that the United States has slidden into a pattern of really drastic social inequality. And that inequality, he says, could lead into problems. And not only that, could lead us down the road of real trouble. And he said it would be okay if everyone was successful. But we're not. We're a very unequal society. The CEO suites on Wall Street, they're well stocked with top shelf everything. Main Street, we're lucky to fill our cupboards with the store brands. So there's that idea of sacrifice. I'm not getting it. When I see the CEO salaries going through the roof, when I see the bonuses through the roof, when I see the hedge fund managers lining their pockets and paying 15% capital gains, and some guy losing his home because he lost his job, because we outsourced it, because Wall Street needed a little bit more, I get pissed off. And I think you should too. So this whole discussion about, oh, gee, you know, times are tough. We got to put Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, all those things that helped us. We got to put that on the table sometime. Some is just idiotic to me. And the question is, why are we screwing with Social Security? It's fine. If we do nothing, nothing at all, and I think most people agree we do nothing at all, it's going to pay every penny to the year 2036, every penny. And then from that point on infinitum, it's going to pay 80% of the benefits. If we did nothing to it, if we just left it the hell alone. There's $2.6 trillion in that fund. Now, the Republicans want to tell you, like Bush, when he went around with his filing cabinet, hey, just IOUs, just a bunch of IOUs and filing cabinets. Yeah, IOUs backed by the full faith and credit of the federal government, the safest investment in this universe. And the Republican Party is fiddling with that. The fact that our treasury bills are the safest investment on this planet, and they're screwing with it, should scare the hell out of every person in this country. And I look at Jeb Bush's kid, Snotty Bush, I call him. Snotty had got a little zinger of a line. Woo-hoo-hoo. I'm gonna see a UFO before I see a Social Security check. Oh, that sounds so good, but it isn't reality. It isn't reality, but it's in your ear all the time, so people start to buy into this because they really want to stick it to the working class. You have something that they want. They want that $2.26 trillion. They want that $2.6 trillion, so they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street, or better yet, they're not going to have to pay the part that they took back. You know, there are a number of cons in the Senate right now. Mike Lee, Pat Toomey, a number of these conservatives, these con jobs. They want to go to this cap and cuff system. We'll raise the cap, but we're going to handcuff you. So no more, you're going to have a balanced budget amendment, which, you know, is in theory sounds great. And I would be all in favor of if that balancing came at, so, well, you know, like at the Smith household, when the bills come in and I don't have enough money, I'm going to have to take it from somewhere or bring in extra revenue. I'm in favor of that. But if it means cutting shoes and cutting clothing for my kids and cutting opportunity for my children, I'm not going to fly there. But that's what the Republicans want. And it's borne out time and time again. And it's just plain nuts. And I'll tell you right now, the president, unless he's got an ironclad plan, unless this is the best poker game I've ever seen, unless this is Wild Wild West and he's James Garner and the other guy, he better hope the Republicans' plan, that voter ID plan, works and they kick all these grannies off the rolls before next November. That's just the way I see it. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Scott Keyes from Think Progress talk about the budget. And, well, Republicans are talking about impeaching him over the debt limit that they're holding us hostage over. Right back after this.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Connecticut has one of the highest deficits in the country as a percentage of its budget. When the new Democratic Governor Dan Malloy came into office in January, he proposed a package of tax increases, budget cuts, and state employee concessions to balance the budget. Melissa Tuhus reports on how the agreement with the state's 45,000 public workers blew up.
The budget deal Malloy reached in May included an agreement with leaders of the state's 15 public employee unions for $1.6 billion in givebacks or other savings. The alternative was thousands of layoffs, up to 15% of the workforce. While 57% of union members voted in favor, union rules require an 80% majority for approval. The deal imploded in late June. It would have included increased contributions to health care and pensions, but also included no layoffs for 4 years and 3% wage increases in the last 3 years of the 5-year deal. Malloy says he will not renegotiate the agreement, and union leaders say they can't change the rules after the fact to let a simple majority ratify it. Governor Malloy says he's happy to explain the deal again, but not renegotiate it. John Young is chapter president of an AFSCME local of administrative employees at Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven.
I think maybe they'll be hoping they can go back to the governor and maybe adjust the agreement itself and then possibly have a revote on it.
Without an agreement, layoffs of up to 6,000 workers will start in September. I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven for Workers Independent News.
President Barack Obama has a new director of recovery for auto communities and workers. Youngstown, Ohio Mayor Jay Williams will be leading the Office of Recovery for Auto Communities and Workers, which replaces the Council on Automotive Communities and Workers. That council was created by executive order in 2009. The ongoing goal of the office is to help identify ailing auto communities where resources are lacking and to help those communities get back on track toward revitalization. Williams was chosen due to the economic development that has taken place in Youngstown under his leadership. In the executive order, the Obama administration says that over the last 2 years, 115,000 auto industry jobs have been created. That's after a loss of 400,000 jobs between 2008 and 2009.
Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alerts.
Well, the hostage situation continues, T-minus 25 and counting, to August 2nd. But again, you know, what's got me frustrated is it looks like, it's like we're caving on this, as I thought we would do. But some interesting story I came across today, that there's been some talk of actually impeaching President Obama over this debt ceiling thing. And I just had to find the guy who wrote it. Scott Kies, over at Think Progress came out with this piece. GOP Congressman, House Republicans have privately discussed impeaching Obama over debt ceiling. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rick. Appreciate it.
This seems ludicrous to me.
You and me both. We're just, holding our breath out here, hoping that some of these Republicans come to their senses and quick.
Well, I mean, I got to be honest. Part of me says, go ahead, try and impeach him.
You know, I mean, I could definitely see it in a situation like in 98 where, you know, Republicans went all in on, you know, the craziest right-wing idea they could think of, and the American public was just really disgusted by it. That, by all means, they should have had a landmark year and, you know, ended up having a really awful midterm election. This could be Obama's ticket to re-election, but you know, I'm just not sure that it'll end up being good for the country if we have to go through an impeachment battle here.
Well, I mean, there's part of me that goes, this is what the Republicans want. They want to be able to stop any progress. They want to be able to, they want to make sure that the economy comes to a screeching halt so that they can, in 2012, say, look what he did, and do like McConnell says. We want to make him a one-term president.
It's a tough situation because, you know, the worse the economy does, the better the Republicans think their chances would be in 2012. Exactly. And so, you know, it's worrisome about what could be the consequences and implications of that, considering that we might be defaulting on our debt as a result.
Well, do you think people understand the severity of that? Do you think that, you know, we've gotten it in our head that, and I hear this on right-wing radio all the time, that we're exceptional and that everyone will bow to us and that we're superior and that none of these bad things, none of these negative effects could possibly happen to us. So do you think there's some kind of superiority complex that we're just not getting the reality of what could be?
I think they're just pulling the wool over their eyes. You know, a number of Republican congressmen who we've talked to are just, you know, so fervently anti-Obama and anti-Democrat that they're willing to do whatever it takes in order to toe the Tea Party line. You know, Congressman Ron Paul says all the time that it would be kind of a good thing if we defaulted on our debt because then it would serve as a wake-up call. You know, others like Senator Mike Lee of Utah have said similar things. So, you know, I'm worried just about the amount that, you know, they're dislike for the president is leading them to push the country over an economic cliff.
Yeah, I mean, you can say what you want about the Democrats and Bush during the Bush years. And there was definitely some, you know, some hatred there. But I don't know, and you know, they raised the debt limit, I think, what was it, 7 times during the Bush years? I don't ever remember the Democrats taking this kind of a stand where they were holding the country hostage.
That's exactly right. And, you know, we remember this exact type of thing. We came within, you know, a couple hours of the entire government shutting down just a couple months ago. We might see that exact same thing play out again in a couple months. We're going to face the, you know, the tax fight again next year. And every single time it's the Republicans essentially holding the country hostage and saying, you know, if we don't get what we want, we're willing to see the economy tank and crater as a result. And, you know, to their credit, they're unfortunately winning a lot of these battles because Democrats and Obama are acting responsibly and not letting the country go into these dire economic consequences. But, you know, it's just really a shame that we have an opposition party that's willing to stoop that low.
Well, it's scorched earth. It's the scorched earth mentality. They don't care. I mean, and I've been making that point over and over again because they know that the Democrats have a major flaw. And that major flaw is that they care about people. And, you know, they care if they have to walk down the street and see people dying in the street. As where I think Republicans would just walk on top of them. Oh, hey, they paved the roads. That kind of mentality.
Yeah, you know, and we're seeing that play out, in all too real consequences. Like you said, we're just, you know, less than a month away from potentially defaulting on our debt. Not just, you know, bringing the American economy to a halting screech and really a crash, but the entire world economy we would bring down with it. You know, this is just a group of a couple hundred Republicans in Washington, D.C. who are willing to see the entire worldwide economy crater so they can, you know, toe the Tea Party line. It's absurd.
Well, how much of it do you think that they're really willing to do that? And how much is it that they know, like Dick Cheney knew, that eventually the Democrats will cave? That's what they do.
It's hard to say, you know, exactly one way or the other, but I think the tough part of the situation is that Democrats aren't willing to bet and find out whether or not they're serious. And, you know, to the credit or not, these are really, really high stakes. This is, you know, Russian roulette with the worldwide economy. I don't blame President Obama for not wanting to play that game. Even though it's really sad and unfortunate that we might see the Democrats rolling, and you know, some of these really disastrous economic consequences playing out as a result.
Now, you've talked to some of these representatives. What's the basis in impeachment? What would be the basis? Because I've been racking my brain. What's the idea?
Well, you know, as I'm sure your listeners well know, there's really very, you know, marginal circumstances where the Constitution allows for impeachment. They only allow it in treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. In this particular situation, what we've got going on is that last month, the Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner, came out and said, you know, the debt ceiling might actually be unconstitutional because in the 14th Amendment it says the validity of the public debt of the United States shall not be questioned. Therefore, it would actually be unconstitutional to have this debt ceiling that resulted in a default. The administration itself hasn't taken a position one way or another on this, but Republicans are already, you know, starting to get really scared on it because if there were to not be a deal to raise the debt ceiling and then the administration were to just say, were to say that, you know, this is unconstitutional, this debt ceiling, we're going to keep paying our debts and not default, then Republicans don't get any of the, you know, deep social budget cuts that they're looking for. So they're starting to get really scared about this. Congressman in South Carolina, Tim Scott, just this week said to a town hall that it would be an impeachable act if President Obama were to, you know, declare the debt ceiling unconstitutional. And then today we talked to my colleague Lee Fung and I talked to Congressman Pete Olson out of Texas about, you know, impeachment and what it was going to be like and whether or not this was being discussed among others. And, you know, we essentially expected him to say, oh, it's just Tim Scott. You know, he was just messing around or something. But he said, no, this is something that, you know, a lot of House Republicans are discussing, where he specifically said, you know, Tim Scott is not a lonely voice on this issue. It's something that we're considering.
Yeah, I look at this stuff, and none of this stuff is ever just happens. It's always well planned. Much like when Cantor stormed out of the debt talks a couple of weeks ago, you find out later they've been planning that for weeks. So is this something that maybe we're going to see in the next couple of weeks, especially if the president says we can't come up with a deal and I can't allow someone's got to be the adult in the room. I can't allow us to default.
Right. I mean, I think it's partly, you know, trying to convey a threat to the president that if he were to go this route and not let the country, you know, collapse, you know, let the economic situation of the country collapse, that they would bring articles of impeachment against him, trying to, you know, force his hand and basically say, you know, you better not do that. But, I'm just worried that either we've got a really horrible choice here, either default on our debt and have the disastrous consequences of that, or have a situation where we're facing an impeachment against the president for you know, essentially saving the countries and the worldwide economy.
Well, that's an argument I wouldn't mind making to the American people, especially.
I think we would be on extremely firm ground making it, but gosh, you know, you just hope that the country can focus on more important things than something like that.
And that's really the point, I think, of this whole discussion, then. There are more important things than this political, you know, Johnson waving, if you will. There are more important things. People need jobs. There's infrastructure that's crumbling. Children need to be educated. We need to start having, a manufacturing policy, maybe an energy policy, maybe a whole bunch of things that are not being done because we're playing this political chicken.
It's really, you know, it kind of like we're living in bizarro world. You see poll after poll after poll show that, not just a slim majority, but a vast majority of Americans say jobs is absolutely the number one priority. Deficit reduction polls in about, you know, the low teens compared to like 50, 60, 70% of people who say, you know, the Congress ought to focus on providing jobs. And yet here we are facing, you know, $2-4 trillion in cuts that's just going to really harm the economy and really hinder the economic recovery. It's a bizarro world that we're living in, and gosh, one that's being all too much controlled by the, you know, the conservative wing of the Republican Party.
You know, I've got on my desk a 48-page document with 27 pages of smiling white people patting each other on the back and 21 pages of fluffy language cut and paste from the Heritage Foundation and otherwise called the Pledge, the grand pledge that the Republicans ran on in November, talked all about jobs. We're going to create jobs. It's jobs, jobs, jobs. Yet I'm not seeing it. All I'm seeing is...
Have you seen the jobs bill come from them?
Yeah, I have, actually. It's the same crap that they've been trying to ram down our throat for 30 years. Tax cuts for the wealthy and deregulation for corporations.
Yeah, you know, we saw how well that worked in the 2000s.
Well, we've seen how well it's worked since they've been doing it. We've lost tens of millions of manufacturing jobs. We've lost a middle class, but we have a billionaire class, and we should be very grateful for our billionaires.
Right, and, you know, it's just a matter of following the money, seeing who's actually controlling the shots here, and then you'll see what kind of legislation is coming up on this. I think that plays a really outsized role in seeing why we're not getting more focus from the Congress on these types of jobs bills that would really help the American people.
That would surely be nice, Scott. Scott, I appreciate the time, and I appreciate the great work you guys do over there at Think Progress. Good stuff. Thanks so much.
Likewise, Rick. Appreciate it.
Scott Kies, thinkprogress.org. Going to take a quick break. Right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Back to America. Rick Smith.
One person was giddy with excitement upon hearing President Obama's announcement that all of America's combat troops would depart from Afghanistan by 2014. Hamid Karzai. A moment of happiness for Afghanistan, exalted the incurably corrupt, inept, weak, and pompous Afghan president. Our leaders put this ingrate in power, and the lives of our soldiers and billions of our tax dollars have been spent to prop up his sorry excuse for a government, yet he's the one saying, good riddance. It puts the dumb in dumbfounding. The dumbest and most shameful aspect of America's 10-year Afghan war is the pretension that Karzai represents some flowering of democracy. Nonsense. Installed in the presidency by dictate of the Bush-Cheney regime in 2002, he's widely despised and ridiculed by Afghans and has clung to power through fraud and autocratic power plays. For example, in last year's parliamentary contest, Karzai was PO'd that 62 candidates he favored lost or were disqualified by the country's Independent Election Commission because of fraud. So, Hamid haughtily set up his own special court to review those results. The day after Obama's withdrawal announcement, Karzai's kangaroo court disqualified the 62 parliamentary winners, replacing them with his chosen ones. Of course, the 62 winners are refusing to budge from their seats, which has created a governmental stalemate. But this suits Karzai perfectly, for the stalemate allows him to rule without parliament. As a top opposition leader puts it, Karzai does not believe in the rule of law. He thinks democracy doesn't work in his favor. This is Jim Hightower saying, it's both insane and immoral for our leaders to cause even one more American to die for Karzai. Tell Obama to bring all of our troops home pronto. The White House comment line is 202-456-1111. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all.
It's class warfare. My class is winning, but they shouldn't be.
A working class hero is something to be.
The taxation system has tilted toward the rich and away from the middle class.
A working class hero is something
to be. Well, you know, he's at it again. And, you know, here's the thing. We really don't know what's going to happen if the Republican hostage situation in Congress isn't over by August 2nd. We don't. We don't know what happens with that deadline. We know the government will default. They're going to default on their obligations. What we don't know is what that's going to mean. And Warren Buffett, the guy who you just heard say, you know, class warfare, my class is winning, but we shouldn't be. The taxation is shifted toward the rich and away from the middle class. We've seen all the wealth move upward. He gets it. He's one of the people saying, hey, tax me a little more so I can have better roads and bridges and schools so we can hire workers and get products to market. He gets it. A lot of business owners get it. A lot of wealthy people get it. It's that handful, that politically active handful of billionaires who fund the Roves and these think tanks, the Heritage Foundations, and all of these Americans for prosperity. So what Buffett said, he said, you know what? Lawmakers are playing Russian roulette with the economy. Quote, if you gave me a six-shooter, Buffett said, and stuck a bullet in one chamber and said, spin it, and five times out of six, nothing bad is going to happen. But we really haven't done this before, so we're not sure what's going to happen when the sixth one is pulled. He said, it's just silly to do. He continues by saying, you really don't have any business by playing Russian roulette to get your way. We should be more grown up than that. You know, here's the thing. This isn't the first time that we've been in trouble. And Buffett acknowledged that. You know what? There was a time, he says, we had a debt at 120% of GDP, far higher than what we have now. You know, after World War II had this 120% GDP. And no one went around threatening, we're going to ruin the credit rating of the United States or something to get a better balance sheet of debt to GDP, Buffett said. We just went about our business then. People did it in a cooperative way. And the thing is, like, Buffett's Right. He said, you know what, this hostage situation, man, it's going to make this country look bad. We're going to have problems. And he said, you know, you're playing with fire when you don't need to be playing with fire. We don't need to tell the rest of the world that any time people in Congress start throwing a tantrum, that we're not going to pay our bills. And he's right. I mean, I wish I could do this with my bank and not have to worry about consequences. He said, this isn't a great pattern to project for the rest of the world. We're supposed to be the leaders. Remember the Republicans saying, oh, we're the, you know, Obama's ceding the leadership of the country. He wants us to follow. Is this the leadership that we want the rest of the world to follow? This kind of petulant child? This kind of two-year-old mentality? This kind of, if I don't get my way, I'm going to take my ball and go home? Is that the way we're going to go? I sure hope not. And Buffett, you know, was quite frank. He said, look, the country will be amazed at how well the unemployment rate drops when housing and construction recovers. When we get people back to work. It's that simple.
The U.S. Chamber of Commerce actually this week came out and said, hey, you know, this is crazy. We're going off a cliff. He said, for the sake of the economic future of this country and for the sake of the businesses in this country, you cannot do this. And let's face it, the chamber is usually not on the side of the president. And I think with the president, and I hope some pundits seem to think that the president is counting on Republicans not accepting it. He's going to put a lot out there on the floor. He has even said he'll probably anger a lot of his allies in Congress, and he certainly will, depending on what it is. He's hoping, I believe, that they refuse it, and he can say to the American people, "Look, I tried, but they weren't willing to compromise." And in doing that, if that happens, that will. In spite of the fact that he's playing Russian roulette a little bit. If that happens, I think it will put him in a little better stead for his run on the presidency. But I hope for the sake of the middle class, he doesn't. What if the Republicans accept it? Then we've given a major, and I agree with you on this, Rick, he's given the Republicans a major, major victory.
I mean, it's been their wet dream from the beginning. Destroy Social Security. And, you know, there's the whole discussion, well, you know, we can means test, we can do this, we can do that. I say the first thing you need to do is you need to fund it. If we can't raise the cap a little bit, we can't change the calculation on how you're funding it a little bit, maybe fiddle around the edges there on how it's funded. Before we start talking about cutting people's benefits, there's something wrong.
I'm not so sure that the Republicans are going to agree to it. Even if Obama comes out with a good number of givebacks.
Here's my premise from
a lot of people in the Republican Party who say no taxes, and that includes no taking away tax breaks for the corporate America. Now, what kind of numbers? You know, the pundits are saying if it's 40-50, yeah, but if they have 80 votes, 80 Republican adamant votes, it could get ugly.
You know, I go back to the good socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower. Should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment, insurance, eliminate labor laws? You wouldn't hear from them again. Their numbers are negligible and they're stupid. Here we are just 60 years later, and you've got a political party who wants to destroy labor unions. You've got a political party that's working their behinds off to get rid of and destroy unemployment insurance. And now they want to go after Social Security. The fact that it's even on the table is a victory for the Republicans. The fact that we have pushed this bar so far, we have picked up the goalposts and moved it so far to the extreme right that it's even a consideration at this point. Given the political climate, I mean, I think if you walked up to people on the street and said, hey, you should be cutting Social Security before taxing the rich, 90% of the people would say no. But we have a political system based on campaign cash that has put this front and center. We haven't done anything to create jobs. And, you know, the Republicans are doing everything they can possibly do to hold this economy back. Because they, if you remember, back when the Bush collapse happened, they really wanted a harder down. They really wanted a collapse. And I think Pat Toomey said it best.
I think we would have a hard down. Look at the mortgage.
Yeah, I think Toomey said it best. If I would have plugged in the damn thing.
I think we would have had a harder down. I think we would have taken a hard down. Look at the mortgage. We would have had probably a tough, road down. I think the markets might have hit lower lows. I think we might have had even a bigger spike in some of the other problems. But we would be on a road for a sustainable recovery.
And why is it important? Why is that harder down thing important? Because if you remember, they were against the recovery bill. They wanted that harder down. They poison-pilled it to death. That's why they've obstructed, opposed, and roadblocked everything that has any prospect of creating jobs. Why is it important to want this harder down? Why would the wealthy want it? Well, I mean, the wealthy and the Republicans who seem to be their lackeys, they can weather the storm. They can make it through the rough times. And the second part is, in weathering the storm, they're able to profit from it. Look at this housing crisis. The banks aren't interested in people staying in their homes. They're interested in taking the homes. They're interested in taking them because these people have already paid a couple years on it. They've made a good buck back. They're going to hold on to them. They're going to sell them off, and they're going to make big profit. And what did they do in the process? They stole a whole bunch of wealth from the working people of this country, and they put it in their pockets. And the third, the most important part of this whole thing, is the Stockholm Syndrome kicks in. And then we're grateful. We're grateful for the rich people. Oh, thank you, rich people. Thank you for saving us. And we hear it now. They give us jobs. Thank you. Thank you for giving us jobs. Oh, we're so appreciative. I mean, I'm just having a hard time wrapping my head around this. You know, we've got 9% unemployment, upwards of 20% underemployment. So what do the Republicans want to do with their transportation reauthorization proposal? They want to cut a third of the funding for the transportation. They want to cut 500,000 jobs in a year. You know, if you want to fill your coffers, you want to fill those tax coffers, get people building stuff again. And Buffett's right. Get the building stuff. We've got roads that are crumbling. We've got outdated, overburdened transit systems. We've got bridges that are falling apart under our feet. We have an enormous need for public transportation. It took me 30 minutes to get into Harrisburg this afternoon. And I have no idea why. All I know is it took me 30 minutes. And I've seen reports, we've got a need somewhere in the $3 trillion range for our infrastructure. And you've got Republicans who are doing everything that they can do to chop out the bottom of it, to make sure that they underfund it and defund it. Why? Because it's good for them. You know what bugs me? The past 30 years, we've been celebrating these politicians who cut taxes for millionaires and billionaires and then take big smiling pictures. Oh, look what we did. And then they got their big their pictures with the big cardboard checks with our taxpayer dollars going to corporations. And it doesn't help us. They simply divvy up their haul with the upper crust. And, you know, the rest of us, well, we can walk to work. We've not invested in our country. And transportation is one of those areas where you get a bang for your buck. That investment pays dividends for years into the future. But I guess we don't think about it. Maybe, you know, maybe I'm just the wrong one here, but I want to invest in the area. I want to invest in my country. Maybe the Republicans know something that we don't. That business has already left us behind, and there's no point in investing. Maybe that's what the Republicans already know. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this. Beat up cars, tires, and covers go.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
With the PSECU Home Equity Line of Credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer is a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Interesting story out of Madison, Wisconsin. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports a 25-foot inflatable likeness of Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice David Prosser was erected outside the Capitol today. The giant balloon was constructed using $10 worth of plastic, drop cloths, and some duct tape. But here it was, what it was there doing, it was choking people. Yes, because the Supreme Court justice evidently, you know, there are a bunch of reports and it's under investigation, evidently choked one of the other justices. And you know, there's part of me likes that kind of enthusiasm. Maybe a little bit.
Here's the question, Rick. What's to investigate? There are people in the room. He choked her. I mean, this has been going on now, what, for 3-4 weeks? I mean, how long would an investigation take? Could politics be rearing its ugly head again?
Here's the thing that I think they don't really want to get out. All those people in the room are lawyers, so the first thing they did is lawyered up. They're not answering any questions. So investigators are going to have a little hard time legally, you know, just getting through all of that. So interesting stuff. Also from Wisconsin, some interesting news. The governor, you remember back during the whole occupation there in Wisconsin, Governor Walker was trying to steal collective bargaining rights from those greedy teachers and those overpaid nurses and those lazy public service workers, you know, the people who pick up your trash and answer the 911 calls and, you know, do all that other stuff that, yeah, we really don't need. Remember that? Remember he was trying to steal their collective bargaining rights? And then he actually did, thanks to David Prosser, who was choking the other justice, over this very issue, which is kind of interesting how it ties together. Turns out that now that theft, you know, from those greedy teachers and those nurses and those public service workers, that theft of their rights, actually now going to be a pretty big boom for another class of people. Prison inmates are going to be very, very, very happy. And you go, well, how's that? How's that work? How are the prisoners benefiting? Well, it's going to happen, and we've already started to see it. Those prisoners are going to start taking jobs of those unionized workers, you know, to do parts of do some work there in parts of Wisconsin. And there's part of me that says, I bet my bottom dollar that was their plan all along. And there's part of me that believes that kind of thought is coming here. This is conservative world. This is what conservative world looks like. Debtors' prisons. Don't pay your bills, go to debtors' prison. Or like the guy who was running for governor in New York said, well, take those poor people and put them in the prisons, teach them how to wash themselves. You know, basically work all day, bread and water at night. Sounds like a great thing. The Madison Capital Times reported, besides losing their right to negotiate over the percentage of their paycheck that will go towards health care and retirement, unions also lost the ability to claim work as union-only jobs, opening the door for private workers and, evidently, even inmates to step in and take their place. You know, we've seen in the private sector a lot of jobs going to prisons. Most people were shocked to find out that airplane reservations and a lot of catalog sales were taken by prisoners, that they actually hired people in prison to do those kind of call center jobs. Alex Seitz-Wald over at Think Progress, she writes, inmates are not paid for their work, but they may receive time off of their sentences. She writes that the law went into effect last week, and Racine County is already using inmates to do landscaping, painting, and other basic maintenance around the county, and that was done, you know, by county workers previously. The union had successfully sued to stop the county from using prison labor in the past, but with Walker's new law, they have no recourse. The ultra-right-wing conservative Washington Examiner called Racine's move another success story and said, all great news for Wisconsin taxpayers. Hope we'll see more of it. And I look at that and I go, you know what? I had made a prediction a couple years ago that we would never see those jobs that left for China, all those manufacturing jobs that left for China. We were never going to see those come back. I may stand corrected. I may have to eat those words. If we can start putting enough people in prison, because understand, we've already got more people per capita. We've already got more people in sheer numbers locked up than any other country in the world. That is the Marx reserve of workers. That's the Marx's theory of the worker, the reserved workforce. We could bring those jobs back from China, use a prison workforce to do it, not have to pay them, give them really big, long sentences, and say, yeah, you know, you work, we'll cut it in half. Sounds like a great plan, doesn't it, Jake?
Absolutely. Not.
But, you know, this is conservative world. This is the kind of thing that, you know, I can see going on. You know, they're already defunding education. They're already defunding many of the public services. They're already defunding our infrastructure across the board. You look at this, the fact that the Republicans want to cut a third of the transportation budget, cutting half a million jobs in 1 year. Well, we've got a 9.1% unemployment rate. This is how they create jobs. This is jobs, jobs, jobs. This is it, man. And the reality is we know that you put money into infrastructure, creates jobs. And it's there for years. It's an investment. You know, you stop and think about the bridges that we cross over every day. You stop and think about the rail lines. You stop and think about all of the infrastructure that our grandparents' generation put into place. You think of the infrastructure during the socialist years of the Eisenhower administration, where we built a highway system that we still use. What if they didn't make that investment? What if they said, no, we need tax cuts? What do you think this country would look like? We are failing on so many levels. And there's so many opportunities. So many opportunities out there to turn our economy around, to turn this country around, to make it the world leader that we should be. But what we've got bickering politicians who want to score political points for their campaign donors. That's all this is about. They've got ideology that's been spoon-fed to them by these well-funded think tanks. And look, the Democrats don't get off easy. They're as much to blame as anybody. I'm harder on Obama over this than I would be if this were George W. Bush, because I have to believe he knows better. And, you know, look, you know, at the end of this, what frustrates me more than anything is I think... I don't care how conservative you are. If you and I sat down across from each other at a table, we could come to an agreement. I truly believe that for the betterment of this country. And I'm not going to question anybody's patriotism. That's not how I do things. Now, the folks on the right, they will absolutely do that. They will absolutely question Obama's patriotism. Oh, well, he's not even an American. He wasn't even born here. He's a Kenyan. I'm not going to do that. I truly believe everybody loves this country as much as I do and wants to see this country succeed as much as I do. But the direction that's going on in Washington right now, the direction over here in Harrisburg right now, is the wrong way to go. The pendulum has swung way too far to the extreme right wing. And my fear, my greatest fear in this, is by Obama putting Social Security on the table, he has scared the hell out of my grandmother and that entire generation, and they are not going to come out for him because he's already ticked off labor. Labor is already infuriated. This is another issue that maybe he loses some more support. But later on in the program, we're going to talk to John Logan from San Francisco State University about the NLRB hearing that went on today. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about investment because there's so many opportunities for us to invest. And you look at, again, this transportation thing just has me crazy. Because there are so many opportunities that we're just allowing to go by the wayside. And that the recovery bill back in 2009, I thought it should have been bigger, should have been chunkier, should have been more spending, less tax handouts, more saying, hey, we need roads, bridges. Here, we want solar panels. We want, you know, we want high-speed rail. Some private company come and build it. We didn't have that. What we had are, here's some tax cuts. Can you maybe think about going spending? It harkens back to the Bush years for me. But again, it was the Republicans who poison-pilled it. It was the Republicans who demanded these tax cuts because that's their ideology. Now, they're hell-bent on kissing the ring of Grover Norquist, who could care less about this country. All he cares about is his bizarre ideology.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
Well, that's about where we are, folks. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
And I'm the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm on till 1 a.m. I must tell you that I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Connecticut has one of the highest deficits in the country as a percentage of its budget. When the new Democratic Governor Dan Malloy came into office in January, he proposed a package of tax increases, budget cuts, and state employee concessions to balance the budget. Melissa Tuhus reports on how the agreement with the state's 45,000 public workers blew up.
The budget deal Malloy reached in May included an agreement with leaders of the state's 15 public employee unions for $1.6 billion in givebacks or other savings. The alternative was thousands of layoffs, up to 15% of the workforce. While 57% of union members voted in favor, union rules require an 80% majority for approval. The deal imploded in late June. It would have included increased contributions to health care and pensions, but also included no layoffs for 4 years and 3% wage increases in the last 3 years of the five-year deal. Malloy says he will not renegotiate the agreement, and union leaders say they can't change the rules after the fact to let a simple majority ratify it. Governor Malloy says he's happy to explain the deal again, but not renegotiate it. John Young is chapter president of an AFSCME local of administrative employees at Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven.
I think maybe they'll be hoping they can go back to the governor and maybe adjust the agreement itself and then possibly have a revote on it.
Without an agreement, layoffs of up to 6,000 workers will start in September. I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven for Workers Independent News.
President Barack Obama has a new director of recovery for auto communities and workers. Youngstown, Ohio Mayor Jay Williams will be leading the Office of Recovery for Auto Communities and Workers, which replaces the Council on Automotive Communities and Workers. That council was created by executive order in 2009. The ongoing goal of the office is to help identify ailing auto communities, where resources are lacking, and to help those communities get back on track toward revitalization. Williams was chosen due to the economic development that has taken place in Youngstown under his leadership. In the executive order, the Obama administration says that over the last 2 years, 115,000 auto industry jobs have been created. That's after a loss of 400,000 jobs between 2008 and 2009.
Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, it is there for your convenience, your entertainment on demand. Also, you can email me, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com. A new UN report out titled Global Trends in Renewable Energy Investment 2011. It is a collaboration of the UN Environment Program, the Frankfurt School of Finance and Management in Germany, and, of course, Bloomberg New Energy Finance. And, you know, it's saying, look, you know, the reality is the investment in renewable energy this past year amounted to a record $211 billion, which is a 32% increase over 2009, and a whopping 540% increase over 2004. Not surprisingly, China led that list with the most invested, somewhere around almost $50 billion, up 28%, accounting for more than one-fifth of the total. And you'll hear this is the very first time, according to the report, that a developing country has beat the wealthy economies in renewable energy investment. And look, they know, as I think everybody knows, whoever becomes the nation that's energy independent dominates the 21st century. Whoever wins this renewable war. And understand, it is. This is going to dictate who the power of this generation is. Who can tell the Middle East to flake off? Who can tell places like Venezuela to flake off? Keep your oil. Who can do that and still produce the energy that they need to keep their economy going? And you know, what's amazing to me is we're not, as a nation, much like the space program, the Manhattan Project, much like, you know, this national coming together moment, Jake, where people say, you know what, this is so important that we need to put all of our energy into developing the best technology. But all I keep hearing is, drill, baby, drill. I'm going to stick some more needles in the ground and screw up the water. That's all I keep hearing, man.
I don't know that that's going to change, Rick, unless the people demand it. It looks like the one party is determined to bow at the altar of political ideology. And again, it comes down to the will of the American people, but that will is going to have to be expressed at the ballot box.
You know, Agency France Press had a good piece on this, and you know, talking about the story and some of the things, you know, that we're investing in is the most mature technology, according to Agency France Press, from the report. The most mature technology, wind, continued to dominate the renewable sector, accounting for some $95 billion of investments in 2010. Solar investments were about $26 billion, and biomass and waste to energy programs amounted to $11 billion, so substantial investment there. But solar, they say, was catching up. If you include these small scale installations, like I put on my house, and I have been having, it's been like a new toy for me. Since they put it online last Friday, I've been watching the little spinner go backwards. I've been watching that number going backwards, as I'm producing energy that we're not using, which means my bill is right now. Since Friday, I have used no energy from the electric company. I've used nothing. And when my bill comes and says zero, I will be as thrilled as can be. That's probably not going to happen because the panels that we have up are only going to account for about a third of our energy usage. Then the wife and kids are off visiting family, so there's nobody at home during the day to use electricity. But still, for this whole week, nothing. Nothing. And my electricity bill is usually $150 to $200 a month.
Does that mean double burgers on Thursday?
Meat Thursday. No. Yeah.
Double burger day?
Well, could be. Could be. But at the end of it, this is an investment that I made, much like an investment that I think we should be making as a country. I chose to make this investment. It's going to take me six and a half years to pay off. But it's going to be there for 25, 30, who knows how long. And it's going to pay dividends into the future, and it's going to do a whole bunch of things. It's going to help us have to use, and what's on my system is it's great. It shows how much CO2 you're saving, how much you're not putting into the atmosphere. So you don't have to buy carbon offshoots, the carbon credits. I can tell how many pounds of CO2 I have not put into the environment. It's pretty cool stuff. But I think we should be doing that on a grand scale. This would have created jobs. This would have created an industry. Private sector jobs would have been created producing the solar panels like I have on my roof that were made in Arizona. And I'm American made, and I made sure of that. But we're not doing that. What we did is we gave tax cuts away. And you look at the countries that are doing it, Germany, France, Italy, the Czech Republic, spending big money on putting solar panels on every roof. I mean, every roof that does not have a solar panel in this country is a lost opportunity to produce energy. Just the way I see it. But we're missing those. We're missing it. And, the more we look at it, this is a failure of the people in Washington to have vision and foresight. And it's a failure of the people in Harrisburg to have vision and foresight. It's a failure of every elected official in every state house across this country to have the vision for tomorrow instead of saying, how is this going to affect me right here, right now, today? And that's all we got. You look at all of this money that we've given away to the big corporations and this budget that they just rammed down our throat here in Pennsylvania. There were no tough choices. There are no tough choices at all. They did exactly, Jake, what I said they were going to do back in January. And I'm not the smartest guy in the bar room. You knew what they were going to do. They were going to kick the people who were already down because they were the easy ones. They were going to beat up the small kid in the room with his hands tied behind his back.
They had a plan and they followed through. And just on the national level, I think the Republicans play the game better. I think to a large degree the same thing holds true in this state. The Republicans, they plan well and they execute and they have more discipline. Unfortunately, for the people of Pennsylvania,
and they've got a media structure that shouts these as successes. They made tough choices. Yeah, cutting education funding, that was a tough choice. Cutting those programs for Granny, that was a tough choice. Cutting the money to the disabled, yeah. Cutting food stamps, yeah. Those are tough choices. Wow, you really probably put a lot of time into that sacrifice. Wow, that's going to cost you down the road. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And what I'm afraid of is it's not. Because the people that they harmed are people who weren't going to vote for them anyway, and they knew that. That was in the calculus. And most of those folks don't vote anyway. That also, last night when we talked to the mayor from Hempstead, New York, one of the things that really grabbed my attention, he said there are 26,000 people that live in his town, in the village of Hempstead, New York. 26,000 people, 4,000 voted.
Wow.
26,000 people and only 4,000 bothered to vote. Do you think you're going to get much attention from the politicos? No. And that's the problem with this country. The working class has not, en masse, gone to the polls and voted their economic interest. We've been too busy worrying about Mary Jane, what Mary Jane's doing with her uterus. and that the uterus is, you know, now a bad word. We've spent so much time being divided and manipulated that we've forgotten pocketbook issues, man. And I'm saying, you know, at some point we've got to start thinking about, our jobs. We've got to start thinking about the direction of the country economically. You know, when you have a vibrant economy, you can argue about those other things. When your kids have a good, safe school to go to with opportunity in front of them, you can argue about those things. All of them. And all of the divisive issues, all of the wedge issues. When you've got kids that are fed and seniors that are being taken care of and disabled people who are getting treatment and help that they need, we can talk about those other things after that. Right now, we don't have those things. But what's happening? We're still being divided. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with John Logan. Right back after this.
Come together. The Rick Smith Show.
One person was giddy with excitement upon hearing President Obama's announcement that all of America's combat troops would depart from Afghanistan by 2014. Hamid Karzai. A moment of happiness for Afghanistan, exalted the incurably corrupt, inept, weak, and pompous Afghan president. Our leaders put this ingrate in power, and the lives of our soldiers and billions of our tax dollars have been spent to prop up his sorry excuse for a government, yet he's the one saying, good riddance. It puts the dumb in dumbfounding. The dumbest and most shameful aspect of America's 10-year Afghan war is the pretension that Karzai represents some flowering of democracy. Nonsense. Installed in the presidency by dictate of the Bush-Cheney regime in 2002, he's widely despised and ridiculed by Afghans and has clung to power through fraud and autocratic power plays. For example, in last year's parliamentary contest, Karzai was PO'd that 62 candidates he favored lost or were disqualified by the country's Independent Election Commission because of fraud. So, Hamid haughtily set up his own special court to review those results. The day after Obama's withdrawal announcement, Karzai's kangaroo court disqualified the 62 parliamentary winners, replacing them with his chosen ones. Of course, the 62 winners are refusing to budge from their seats, which has created a governmental stalemate. But this suits Karzai perfectly, for the stalemate allows him to rule without parliament. As a top opposition leader puts it, Karzai does not believe in the rule of law. He thinks democracy doesn't work in his favor. This is Jim Hightower saying, it's both insane and immoral for our leaders to cause even one more American to die for Karzai. Tell Obama to bring all of our troops home pronto. The White House comment line is 202-456-1111.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous. The salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make it, we make it happen! Ghosted on our time clock, so you might start referencing.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you've got any questions, comments, something on your mind, call us or you can leave us an email. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. So the question then becomes, today was the big day where Congress had their hearing talking about the NLRB. And it was really kind of a kangaroo court, and it was really very interesting to me to see where the radical right stood on workers' rights. They're bending over backwards to say, oh, see, I believe in workers' rights. I do, sure. I just don't want them to actually use them. So when I saw this piece over at The Hill, titled Worse Than Obamacare, Conservatives Demonize the NLRB, I said, we got to get John Logan back here on the program, professor and director of labor and employment studies at San Francisco State University, the piece that he's written over there. We've got it linked at our site at thericksmithshow.com. Professor Logan, thanks for taking time for us.
I'm glad to be on.
So the NLRB is now worse than Obamacare for the Republicans, huh?
Yeah, according to the National Review, and if you listen to the hearing, which is available on streaming video today, there were several threats to take retaliatory action against the board to continue to hold hearings, to revisit the position of the NLRB in Congress. So, I mean, it's, it almost seems to be official Republican policy now to defund the board, to get rid of the board altogether, which is very extreme position, even by the standards of the Republican Party in recent years.
Yeah, I find it amazing that, you know, the Republicans, you didn't hear a peep out of them when the NLRB was beating up on workers and stealing their rights away. But the second that they go, wait a second, there are actually some laws that do protect workers, and maybe, you know, just a thought, maybe we should enforce them, kind of do our job kind of thing. That's when you hear the Republicans lose their minds.
Yeah. And it really is a very, very clear attempt to intimidate the board for carrying out its enforcement obligations. First, with the Boeing case in April, the decision to issue a complaint against Boeing, which the general counsel really, based on the evidence that we know about at least, had very little alternative but to issue the complaint. And then, of course, as you know, I mean, there's a process that goes before the administrative law judge. It can then be appealed to the full board and then appeal to the courts after that. But he had very little alternative but to issue that complaint. And now in June last month, the board came out with some proposed new rules to update these antiquated administrative practices concerning the conduct of NLRB elections, to get rid of the very, very worst cases of delay in NLRB elections that, you know, scrupulous employers are able to delay and delay the process as a way of deliberate tactic to undermine support for unionization. And it's very well known that this goes on. In fact, one of the lawyers, the Republican witnesses today, was from Jackson Lewis, a large management side law firm that specializes in union avoidance. And Jackson Lewis put out an article a few years ago titled Time is on Your Side, that was advocating delay as a way of undermining support for unionization. And now these same people, you know, are appearing before Congress and saying that they have the best interests of employees at heart, that the only reason that they oppose these new rules is that they want employees to be able to hear both sides of the story.
Which, of course,
is laughable, but, you know, it's just an indication of the hypocrisy of these people. But both the measures, the Boeing complaint and now the proposed new rule on elections, are very, very moderate measures. And yet, you know, the response that they've provoked from the Republican side is really quite incredible, and including, as I said, now multiple calls to get rid of the agency altogether, to defund it and to do away with it.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, there's part of me that goes, you know, they were just looking for this moment to go after labor. This has been something they've been talking about in their little think tanks, you know, like giddy little schoolgirls in the cloakroom, hoping, wishing, praying, and they got what they wanted. And now again, they're taking full advantage and really manipulating this and really framing it in a way that most people who don't follow this like we do are swayed by. They have turned the Boeing thing into a thing of freedom and tyranny.
Right.
And I'm saying it's a matter of right or wrong.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. I mean, as I say in the article and as I said before, I mean, they didn't start attacking the NLRB with the Boeing case. I mean, of course, you know, they've always hated the NLRB, but, you know, the Republican Party now is more extreme than perhaps it's ever been, but, you know, certainly more extreme than any time in recent years on labor issues. And they started to attack the labor board. I mean, as soon as Obama came to power, first with the all-out campaign against the nomination of Craig Becker to the board, but then when they took over the House of Representatives in January, there was an immediate attempt to do everything possible to undermine the board. And so they held hearings on several occasions about enforcement issues, about budget issues, but they just didn't, you know, they didn't really get any traction. I mean, but they were certainly, you know, it was clear that they were determined to do whatever they could to cripple the board and to undermine its authority and to undermine its ability to function. Now, as you said, I mean, the Boeing complaint kind of has, you know, given them this sort of red meat issue, that they've been able to frame it in a way to say that, you know, here you have this out of control government agency that's trying to tell a private company where it can and cannot do business, or, you know, alternatively, that it's an attack on the right to work states, or it's an attack on South Carolina and the southern states in general. I mean, all of which are complete nonsense. I mean, and all of which are intended to distract from the central issue, which really the only issue in the case is, which is, you know, did Boeing violate the law? And I really believe, you know, I'm sure Boeing is genuinely outraged by the fact that they have to obey the law. But with a lot of the Republicans, it was really phony outrage, and it was just a really manufactured effort to create this sort of narrative of this agency, government bureaucrats run amok, and this sort of out of control government agency, because we all knew that there was likely to be a new rule, new proposal on NLRB elections. And you know, that is something that concerns them. Even if, you know, even although it's a very moderate rule, is something that they're opposed far more than the Boeing case, because, you know, this is about protecting your workers' right to organize. And even if it will only take a tiny little step in the direction of restoring that right, anything at all that moves in the direction of strengthening the right to organize and bargain collectively is unacceptable
to
today's Republican Party.
Yeah, because, you know, when you control the whole system, you know, it's like when my 5-year-old gets the bag of candy. He doesn't want to share one piece. No. And this is the same kind of scenario.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, the employers at the moment have a stranglehold over the system, and they're not prepared to give up that control in any way whatsoever. And, you know, the Republican Party is, you know, very willing and very enthusiastically doing their bidding for them.
Let me ask you this, Professor Logan. You know, one of the things that caught my attention during the testimony is that I didn't hear anyone, because the Republicans kept hammering this point, well, employers need to be able to tell their side. We need to have time. We need to have as much time so the employers can tell their side, because the unions got time to tell their side. So the employers need to. Why did no one say, wait a second, the employers had from day one when they hired this person to treat them well, to pay them reasonably.
Right.
Why doesn't anybody bring that up?
Well, and not only that, I mean, they have from day one to get across their anti-union message, and they do. And we know this. I mean, this is well documented. So, you know, firms like Walmart, like Home Depot, like, you know, lots of the other big firms have anti-union films that they show, inductions that they use as part, you know, the films that they show as part of the inductions for new employees. Virtually all non-union employers, a large number, include very, very clear statements of their anti-union philosophy in handbooks, employee handbooks for new employees. Multiple large firms hire as senior labor relations managers, human resource managers. If you look at these recruitment ads that they place, they say that they want people who have experience in maintaining a union-free environment and communicating a union-free philosophy. So the notion that, you know, streamlining the election process and getting rid of the very worst cases of a delay, deliberate delay in NLRB elections, will somehow prevent employers from getting their side of the story across is you know, again, you know, completely laughable, and of course completely ignores the fact that employers have exclusive access to employees at the workplace, that they can force people to attend both individual and group anti-union meetings, and they do, and that people can be sacked for refusing to attend these anti-union meetings, which they are.
When you say sacked, do you mean?
They lose their job. They're
fired.
They're terminated.
They're kicked to the curb.
So, we at these hearings, we were told that it was a terrible invasion of privacy, that employers would have to give out email addresses of employees to unions. And yet, you know, they're saying, well, you know, we are the only ones that are allowed to communicate, you know, with employees at the workplace. We can force them to attend these group meetings, these individual meetings. They can be sacked if they refuse to attend. But it's a terrible invasion of privacy if the union has access to contact information outside of the workplace, which is the only place that, of course, that the union has that is able to contact employees. So, you know, it was just another example of this sort of, like, you know, Alice in Wonderland reality that, you know, Republicans inhabit when it comes to labor issues. Yeah. That, you know, it just bears no connection whatsoever with real life of, you know, people's experience of organizing campaigns. And they know this, I mean, but, you know, as you said, I mean, it, you know, for people who don't follow these issues, have not been directly involved in them, you know, they have no problem with saying things that bear no relation to the truth.
And the thing, the only thing that I would correct there is, you know, so that the unions contact these people. No, generally the workers contact the
No, sure, sure,
the unions.
Sure. But that's the only way that they have is outside of the workplace.
Right.
Yes.
And because I think that's important, because the way the right has framed it is, well, unions are out there beating on every employer's door. That's not reality.
No, we know that's not true, of course. Yeah, yeah.
Professor Logan, I appreciate your time, this piece. I appreciate the writing that you're doing, one of the few people out there writing on this issue and doing it very well. Again, we've got a link to at thericksmithshow.com to Professor Logan's piece, Worse Than Obamacare, Conservatives Demonize the NLRB, worth reading. Professor, thanks for the time. Look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Deanne McQueen, Vice President of the National Nurses Union. They're not thrilled with any cuts to social programs, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. We're going to find out after this.
Lord have mercy on the working man.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call them at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Remembering that you we bargain, divided we beg. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So, looks like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid on the table. I'm not sure what that means. Huge cuts they claim may be coming. I gotta be honest with you, I think it's a cave. But we will see as the days go on. Sunday's supposed to be the details. But I saw a piece today that the National Nurses Unions, National Nurses United Union has come out and said, you know what, we oppose any cuts to social programs like Medicare, Medicaid, Security, which is why we've asked their vice president, Deanne McEwen, to come on and talk to us a little bit. Deanne, thanks for taking time for us.
Yes, thank you very much, Rick. It's a pleasure.
You know, I look at this, and again, you know, the president has laid it out on the table. I'm not thrilled with it. Your thoughts?
Well, as a nurse, we know that Social Security is a public health program, and when elderly and poverty-stricken people don't have the money to eat or keep themselves sheltered and clothed, it means a life defined by misery and sickness. And they're going after Medicare, which is really the heart of our American medical system, and it's the part of the system that works best. We need to be expanding it and improving it, not cutting it.
I'm right there with you. I wish during the whole healthcare discussion, I'm not sure it was a discussion, but the whole debacle that went on, we would have talked about a single-payer Medicare for all system.
Well, we weren't allowed a place at the table. We knocked on doors. We sent letters. We sent faxes. We had calls that were hung up on, and, you know, the only way we could get into the public hearing was by basically going in and having ourselves arrested. And we didn't go there to get arrested, but we certainly wanted to advocate for patients and sound public health policy.
So as the nation's largest representative of nurses across this country, what does cuts to Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security mean to the patients, to your members? What's this going to mean going forward, do you think?
Well, I think it's going to be, again, a life that's these are heartless cuts. It's a recipe for pain and heartbreak and people dying unnecessarily in the richest country in the world. And, you know, nearly 100 million Americans are cared for by Medicare and Medicaid and the children's health programs here. So these cuts are cuts to the most vulnerable. And you know, what we're saying to politicians is, what, you know, which side are you on the side of Wall Street and the people that created this financial mess, or are you on the side of Main Street Americans who deserve a secure retirement? And we pay our taxes, and we expect that government and those that we elect to represent us in Washington are going to represent the interests of the voters.
I wish that were possible, but what it seems to be is you've got, especially the Republicans, and I'm siding them out because they're the ones who seem to be holding this whole debt process up, beholden to a handful of very wealthy interests, you know, the big think tanks and all that, who seem to be pushing this agenda. And what scares me is, you know, we used to believe that Social Security was the third rail of politics. You just never touched it. Now it's actually being talked about being on the table. Have we moved that far to the extreme right that now it's something that we're even willing to discuss?
Well, look, what's going on is we're not broke in America, but we certainly are a nation that's deficient right now in political courage and leadership. And it's just time to tell Wall Street and the politicians they finance in Washington that the American people have sacrificed enough. There can be no more cuts in health care programs for seniors or the disabled or disadvantages, and no reductions in retirement security. You know, the facts really are that Social Security doesn't contribute to the deficit, and by law it's self-financed, and it will never contribute to the deficit. So, you know, it just seems ludicrous that anti-government, these ideologues, have been pointing to this imminent crisis in Social Security as a reason to scrap the program.
You mean, you know, the crisis that they created.
Absolutely. You know, these, we can't underestimate the power of these huge financial interests, but, you know, they really want us to give up and believe that our votes won't make a difference here, and that's just it. They may have more money, but we've got more people, and the banking industry and the huge Wall Street investors actually funded the work of the deficit commission because they want our Social Security money and the huge surpluses that have grown as a result of the Greenspan commission work in 1983.
The largest tax increase in the history of civilization.
Yes.
Where they decided that, you know, the workers of that period were going to pay for their own Social Security, raise taxes, all the way up to 6.5% is what it was. And, again, the largest tax increase, single tax increase in history.
They don't want to pay back what they owe to the system, and that's just it. The system right now works very well for the huge financial interests. And so, you know, what we're saying to politics is, this is about accountability, and so we pay our taxes, and then huge corporations in America, GE was recently in the news, millions of dollars that have gone unpaid in taxes.
Well, they paid nothing, and we end up giving them more money. Thank you for the jobs. Here's some more money. Thank you very much. Please outsource some more. So I guess the big question I have then is you know, you guys are against any I guess I'm putting words in your mouth here, against any cuts to Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. These are vital programs, and I'm there with you. I think that we should be doing an awful lot more before we talk about this. But what do you do when it's the president who most labor people supported putting this on the table? Because I got to be honest with you, I'm flipping mad over this.
Well, we have an informed outrage. I think we share that because really we see the misery. It's just heartbreaking out there, the pain and suffering. And so, you know, in exchange for our support, we really just can't give up on holding them accountable for protecting our interests, instituting a just taxation system where the corporations and the wealthy pay their fair share.
Yeah, we live in a country where 400 people, 400, you can put them in a pretty good-sized room, have the exact wealth of 150 million people in this country.
Yeah, that's just it, you know, and they fooled people with this trickle down. It just seems like they're sucking all the wealth up, you know, and it's like, where's our bailout? Why is it that only working people are asked to share the sacrifice? We've given up everything we own, including our health now, and as government should exist to benefit all people. Not just the wealthy, and this unrelenting economic crisis with the highest levels of unemployment in decades, and yet these big corporations have made more money than ever in the last 10 years. It's just ridiculous.
It's criminal.
It's killing people, and you talk about a death panel decision there. That's exactly what these cuts are. So we've had enough of these endless cuts to public education and enough about this rhetoric about how we have to further shred public safety nets while 50 million or more Americans are without health coverage and millions more have they're self-rationing. They don't go in and get needed care. And adult senior daycare centers have closed. Psychiatric hospitals have closed. And women's health services we need a new Bill of Rights and a new contract for the American people puts our interests ahead of Wall Street.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, here's what bothers me. We are very short-sighted in this country. What bothers me is you're going to start cutting back on Medicare and Medicaid. And my grandmother may not have the couple of dollars that she's going to have to chuck in to go see a doctor, and maybe she puts it off. And maybe she gets sicker, and it costs us longer, costs us more down the road, and it ends up costing her life because of it. That kind of stuff bothers me. This short-sightedness that we're gonna do things on the cheap. We're gonna try and we don't want people going to the doctor, so they hold it off until down the road it's something much worse, much more costly. And there's a really jaded part of me that thinks that's how they want it.
Well, nurses, you know, myself included, you know, every week that I go to work, there are people there that are suffering and dying that shouldn't be. A 24-year-old African-American woman, a 54-year-old Korean woman, a 55-year-old man that's at the peak of his career, and all because they are hardworking people. They perform jobs that are vital to the economy. They bring home a paycheck, and then they have to decide if they're going to pay the rent that month or go see a doctor. And it really is not the kind of America that's fair. It's the kind of America that works only if you've got the money to pay for health care, to pay for special services, and that's not what the founding fathers and mothers of this country had in mind.
Yeah, I mean,
the system, equality for all.
The sad reality is without, in this country, if you don't have a job, chances are you don't have health insurance, and if you don't have health insurance and you're sick, chances are you're going to die from it.
Well, and you can't buy things. You can't purchase services, hotel, motel industry, automobile industry, fruits and vegetables, farm workers. It's just like they can't even afford to pay for the crops that they harvest. And so our values as nurses are caring and compassion and community. You know, we're interconnected, and Social Security represents those values. And the people that are going after Social Security and Medicare, they simply have no replacement for these programs. I mean, you know, let them eat vouchers. Put a voucher on that wound. You know, we're hemorrhaging. And it's time, really, that we start protecting the most vital resource we have in this country of all, and that's the people that live and work here.
Absolutely. Last question I have for you. You know, now that this is out on the table and there's a discussion, where do we go? What are you guys going to do? What should we be doing? How do we stop this thing? How do we get it off the table?
What we're doing is we're looking for the Main Street Reinvestment Act and taxing Wall Street with a financial transaction tax, for instance. It could raise revenue that would help support education, provide jobs, health care for people. And we're asking politicians, which side are you on? You don't get our vote. You don't get our endorsement. You don't get our support. Are you going to continue to support tax cuts for the rich and powerful? Or are you going to tax the financial speculators and the Robin Hoods who've been stealing our money and holding us hostage with it, basically, and they're shipping more and more jobs overseas? Or are you on the side of Main Street Americans, a just taxation system where corporations and the wealthy pay their fair share? And let's restore that promise of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all of us. So we're supporting the American Health Care Security Act, Medicare for All, and the financial transaction tax, which a lot of the European Union nations are endorsing as well. And it really will help us get companies to pay taxes and end this financial speculation.
I'm right there with you. Deanne, I appreciate the time. Great conversation. I'd love to have you back, and we got to keep up this fight. We got to fight this back. This is bad stuff all the way around.
Rick, thank you so much for the work you do. You know, we've got more people, and we've got an informed outrage. And you know, they talk about entitlement programs, and you know, the entitlement that we're talking about ending is this arrogant sense of privilege that the banks and the wealthy corporations that don't have to pay taxes, and the rest of us do. So thank you very much.
Well put, well put. Thank you so much, Deanne McEwen, Vice President of the National Nurses United Union. We got a link at our site at thericksmithshow.com. There's a spot for you to take action, and I suggest everyone take action. Sign the petition. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers, in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My caseloads are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job, they're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse. Because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make it, we have it.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Well, you know, I gotta be honest, you know, when I look at this throwing Social Security up on the table. To me, again, it's moving further and further to the right, picking up those goalposts as the, you know, the Democrats have done for the last, you know, 20 years. Continually moving. And again, this is one of those things I thought I'd never see in my lifetime, but there it is. Our stat of the day, from the Too Much Online blog, about 24,000 U.S. taxpayers, make somewhere over, $532,000 a year. They're the top 1%. They're right there up at the top. 24,000 of these folks are not going to pay any federal income tax at all. And what I hear from the right, I mean, look, they love to say, well, you know, 42% of the people pay no federal income tax. It's because they're not making hardly any money. Just what it is. Let's go to the phone lines. I've got Stosh on line one. How you doing tonight, Stosh?
Doing all right, Rick. How are you doing today?
I am great, and I'm getting better every day.
I was talking about these corporate Republicans. The corporate Republicans are the ones who are in office who are being funded by corporations.
Yep.
The rest of the Republicans think the Republicans, they are hoodwinked and bamboozled to think that they're a part of the corporate Republicans that they elected to office. They are not. They're lost. And I'm trying to appeal to them saying, hey, they're trying to take your Social Security. They're trying to take your Medicaid, Medicare. These are Republicans who are hoodwinking you and making you try to think that they're Republicans, but they're not. They're being fed by the corporate ones to hoodwink us into thinking the only way you can counteract that is for all the so-called Republicans to vote this measure down by a voting Democrat come 2012.
Yeah, I'm with you there, brother. But here's the thing, and maybe this is one of those things that I think some Republicans need to understand. This whole destruction of Social Security, all of this push against Medicare and Medicaid, that's been the Republican Party platform from day one. So any Republican who thinks that, and Eisenhower was one of the guys who said, you know, the reality is Social Security's here to stay. We've got to embrace it. The reality is the Republican Party has been one of the group out there fighting against this social progress. They're the ones who've been fighting against a safety net. They want a boom-bust economy. They want desperation. They want people, who are at the margin, Stosh. And what worries me is that there are some, and I've got friends who, you know, they've been Republicans their whole lives, you know, probably because mom and dad were Republicans, and they don't know that stuff. And that's what worries me, buddy.
Yeah, but they'll realize, hopefully, before the election, that they're trying to steal everything they work for. by creating confusion between the races, trying to make Obama the thing, the point that he's ruining the country, when they're the ones being pushed by corporate.
Well, they're puppets. They're bought and paid for. Look at, look at all the things that the think tanks came out and said they wanted. It's basically the policy of the far right right now. Here in this state, we've got the Tea Party Republicans who are pushing, stealing people's right to vote, destroying unemployment compensation, a budget that's harming, the people at the margin. That's the position of the party. And I don't know why there's a working class Republican left in this state or in this country.
That's what my people dropped the ball in the 2010 election. We all turned out for 2008 election for Obama, and then went to sleep in 2010. And that's when they ran the sweep on us. And just now they're changing all the rules. I asked friends of mine, I said, do you know that they changed the voter registration law? No. I said, if you go to the poll, you could turn back. It's because you didn't vote 2010. Don't be upset. So that's why I'm appealing to the white voters. Say, look, that segment of our electorate is going to be not able to vote. So you guys have to step up to save yourself as well as regular people.
Yeah, well, what they just pushed through here in this state, they just, in the House here, the Pennsylvania House, pushed through the voter ID bill, where now you have to have an identification card. Well, what if you don't drive? What if you're my grandmother, for instance, who hasn't driven a car in 10 or 15 years? What if you're someone who doesn't own a car, you live in poverty, and you don't leave your three blocks? There's a lot of questions here. We're going to spend millions of dollars to put this into place.
Mm-hmm.
It makes no sense, especially when we're talking about taking food away from children, taking aid away from the disabled. It makes no sense to me, Stosh. I'm not getting the right's view on this.
Yeah.
It is what it is, brother. I appreciate the call, though. Thanks so much.
All right, Rick. Thank you.
You look at this, and I'm glad that we got a Republican caller who, saying, look, I've seen the light. The reality is we need to be focusing on what working people need. And I wish there were more rational working class Republicans. We bought into this Limbaulian or this Beck view of, it's our team that's going to win, and we're going to do whatever we need to do to take this on. It's kind of ridiculous.
Republicans, and here's where I think they've lost the support, especially the national Republicans have lost support of working class Republicans. The national Republicans have said they always stood for less government. They also always stood for individual freedom. Look at the government today. This government is up by and for the corporate interest. As far as freedom, look what the Bush administration has done. They actually don't stand for what they say they do. And these teabaggers, they disappoint me. I thought there was a chance, and you said it too, there was a chance that we could agree on some issues, but they seem to have caved. I haven't heard one of them talk out about the tax, unjust tax system. I haven't heard one of them talk out against free trade. They have been a real disappointment. And I think, I truly believe, Rick, and I hope it isn't too late, but I truly believe there's going to be a huge backlash in 2012.
No, I hope that's the case, because I'm hoping. But there's part of me that doesn't think it's going to happen, and I'll tell you why. The people that they've gone after, the people that the Republicans have gone after, are people who generally weren't going to vote for them in the first place and generally don't vote. The guy from Hempstead, New York, the mayor from Hempstead, 26,000 people in his town, only 4,000 of them voted. Those are the people, and he said they're highly minority, highly low-class, low-income, working-class folks. Out of 26,000, only four of them bothered to vote. Those are the people who these budgets are going to harm. So they're not, unless there's a mass wave of them coming to vote, which I don't see, they're not going to pay the price. And what the Democrats have done a masterful job of shooting themselves in the foot, circling the wagons and killing everybody inside the wagons, you've ticked off your main constituents, people like me. I support the president on many, many things. But when you start doing really dumb stuff, I got to have a problem with that. Now, look, come November, right now what the Republicans are showing me, there's nobody. There's nobody that I can support on the Republican side of this ticket. Every one of them seem to be cookie-cutter Republicans right out of the Heritage Foundation mold. One more crazy than the other. So, you know, by default, I'm going to support the president. I wish I could have that feeling I had in 2008, Jake, where I went to the polls and I said, held my head up high and said, I'm voting for this guy. I'm not voting against George Bush. I'm not voting against Bob Dole. I'm not voting against George H.W. Bush. I'm voting for this guy.
Well, I think what you're pointing to, and I definitely agree, is how important what's going to happen in the next couple of days. What comes out of this scenario is going to be very key. These are high stakes. Very high stakes. It could really be the determining factor who becomes president of the United States in 2012.
I hope Monday I eat my words. I hope Monday I say, you know what? I come back here and say, I was wrong. He was the best poker player on the planet. We should sign him up for Texas Hold'em. We could solve the deficit problem that way. I hope I'm wrong. But the mere fact to me, and maybe you guys have a different opinion, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Maybe you got a different thought on this. The fact that you put Social Security on the table to me is a loser. The fact that you're opening up the Mexican border, a loser. The fact that we're pushing more free trade agreements, a loser, in my opinion. Your thoughts when we come back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Connecticut has one of the highest deficits in the country as a percentage of its budget. When the new Democratic Governor Dan Malloy came into office in January, he proposed a package of tax increases, budget cuts, and state employee concessions to balance the budget. Melissa Tuhus reports on how the agreement with the state's 45,000 public workers blew up.
The budget deal Malloy reached in May included an agreement with leaders of the state's 15 public employee unions for $1.6 billion in givebacks or other savings. The alternative was thousands of layoffs, up to 15% of the workforce. While 57% of union members voted in favor, union rules require an 80% majority for approval. The deal imploded in late June. It would have included increased contributions to health care and pensions, but also included no layoffs for 4 years and 3% wage increases in the last 3 years of the 5-year deal. Malloy says he will not renegotiate the agreement, and union leaders say they can't change the rules after the fact to let a simple majority ratify it. Governor Malloy says he's happy to explain the deal again, but not renegotiate it. John Young is chapter president of an AFSCME local of administrative employees at Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven.
I think maybe they'll be hoping they can go back to the governor and maybe adjust the agreement itself and then possibly have a revote on it.
Without an agreement, layoffs of up to 6,000 workers will start in September. I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven for Workers Independent News.
President Barack Obama has a new director of recovery for auto communities and workers. Youngstown, Ohio Mayor Jay Williams will be leading the Office of Recovery for Auto Communities and Workers, which replaces the Council on Automotive Communities and Workers. That council was created by executive order in 2009. The ongoing goal of the office is to help identify ailing auto communities, where resources are lacking, and to help those communities get back on track toward revitalization. Williams was chosen due to the economic development that has taken place in Youngstown under his leadership. In the executive order, the Obama administration says that over the last 2 years, 115,000 auto industry jobs have been created. That's after a loss of 400,000 jobs between 2008 and 2009.
Workers' rights under attack. What do we do?
Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get paid too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again, because God is a Republican.
Yes, and he hates poor people, wants them to get a job. Get off the welfare. You don't need food stamps. Like Michelle Bachman said, you know, we just believed in God, and God sent us food, and we were okay. We didn't take handouts from government. We just took handouts from neighbors, which basically, if you stop and think about it, that's what our government is. It's we the people. It's all of us coming together to make sure that, you know what, we have a safety net. And that people don't fall through that. That people don't go hungry. People aren't sick. People aren't homeless. And there's a common theme. There's kind of a theme there, if you think about it. And, you know, this is where the whole, you know, America's a God-fearing Christian country, I kind of buy. You know, the whole idea that we take care of our neighbors. We are our brother's keeper. We do want to make sure that the sick are taken care of and the hungry are fed and the naked are clothed and all of that. You know, that whole Matthew 25 thing and all the Sermon on the Mount thing and, you know, all that stuff that we don't seem to spend much time really believing, at least policy-wise.
But, Rick, I think it's worse than that. I think the Republicans have lost the concept, at least the very conservative ones and the Tea Party. They've lost the concept of we're all Americans. We've lost the concept that, and I do believe this, we're all in this together in this country. And we are, in general, most of us. They've lost that concept.
And
you can call it what you want. I guess part of it is patriotism, but it's a practical patriotism. That if we take care of each other, we take care of these nations, everyone will prosper and we'll be a better nation. And the irony is, Rick, if we take care of the middle class and nurture the middle class, you know what? The rich are going to get their share. They are going to get their share, always have, always will. That's the irony of it.
You lie! You hate America!
See, we need rich people need to have everything. See, you keep telling those liberal gibberish lies. The raise up the bottom and the rich will get richer by having consumers with money.
Well, let me ask you something, Rick. When, you know, you talk about the socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower. When the top tax rate was 92%, what were the rich living in slums? You know, were they begging for bread? No, hardly. The rich have always survived and always will survive.
They only had three houses. That's it. They didn't have seven.
And they only had one lousy yacht.
That's right, just one yacht.
And ain't that a pity?
Here's some news out of Louisiana. Louisiana Governor Bobby Jingle. He signed a bill into law recently that now requires women's health clinics to post signs notifying patients of alternatives to abortions. Like these folks didn't know there were alternatives. Gee, they woke up and go, there's no alternative. There's no alternative. What was interesting about this, though, at the big ceremony that they had, Jindal said he was proud to help to make the state one that supports a culture of life, which is kind of like Texas. We support a culture of life, even though we're going to electrocute people. But he said, you know, he added that women will soon be treated similar to criminals who are read their rights after an arrest. And that's kind of a weird thing to say. When officers arrest criminals today, they're read their rights. Now, if we're giving criminals their basic rights and they have to be informed of those rights, it only seems common sense that we would do the same thing for women. And, you know, I had this discussion recently with a friend of mine who is a big, far out, you know, just staunch Republican. And he is stuck on the abortion issue. And that's what makes him a Republican. That's the issue that draws him. And he, you know, he wears the shirts and the hats and bumper stickers all over the cars, yet he agrees with almost none of the economic policies. He doesn't believe in free trade, believes strongly in the right to join and form unions. In fact, a union member himself, right down the line economically, he's probably more liberal than I would ever be. Probably he's a socialist, but it's that one divisive issue that's never going to go away. And what bothers me about the abortion issue, and you can call me pro-abortion. I'm not, but you can call me that because I'm pro-safety. I don't want my daughters ever to have an abortion. I don't want them to ever be in a position where they feel they need to even think about that. But if they do, I want them to be safe, because it's not going to stop. If you listen to our history, not going to stop. Abortions are always going to be here. The wealthy, they'll be able to have private doctors come take care of their little problems, as they have done in the past. So this is not about, am I for it or am I against it? Personally, I'm against it, but I'm pro-safety. I want to make sure that my kids are safe. I want to make sure that other people's children are safe. What I would love to see, and I go back to the budgets, because budgets are moral documents. The family values people keep telling me how wonderful they are and how good God-fearing Christian they are. Yet they slash programs that help the poor. They slash programs that help children. They slash education. What would make a woman want to bring a child who can't afford that child into this world, given that they're going to be demonized and vilified? Sorry, I'm just not getting it. Not getting it at all. How many people have heard the story of, you know, I guess I go back and I think about my mother. And, you know, I remember this story, and I hate talking about abortion because it's really not an issue that I'm all that comfortable with, for one. But I think it's just absolutely ludicrous that you would have a governor, I guess it is Louisiana after all, but you'd have a governor who says, we want to basically treat these women like criminals. We want to criminalize this moment between a doctor and the patient. I mean, stop and think about this for a while. It's just like the war on drugs. How idiotic was the war on drugs? We're now, after what, 35 years, coming around going, well, you know what, probably not a great idea. Has the war on drugs gone away? No. It's actually gotten more lucrative. And I think the same thing will happen when we criminalize a woman's right to choose. Because that's what you're talking about doing. You're not going to stop it from happening. It's not going to stop. Which is what, you know, I keep trying to tell my buddy who's this, you know, that's the only issue he votes on. It's the only issue he cares about. That's all I care about. Don't care about anything else. He's got to be pro-life. But I want him to go blow up people in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I want to fry those people on death row. But I'm pro-life! Explain that to me, because I'm not getting it, Jake. It's just one of those things not sinking into my thick skull. But the idea of criminalizing this, much like we've done to marijuana and other drugs, just nonsense.
Well, you would think those who, if you want to be consistent, if you're pro-life, when it comes to abortion, you would be pro-life in the death penalty, but it's usually the opposite way around. They're for the death penalty, but they're for all women taking their pregnancy to full term.
They're pro-birth. Once it pops out, you're on your own, honey. And then you're vilified and you're demonized. Oh, sorry, we can't give you food and we can't get you food stamps, and we're gonna make you jump through hoops if you do need them.
That's another thing that's a contradiction, I would say, an hypocrisy on their side. Many of those same conservatives, when you talk about taking care of the children, oh, no, not me. I didn't have the child. I shouldn't bear any responsibility. Oh, no, not me. No. Well, you know what? You passed a law which said every child, every pregnancy should be taken to full term. And once those babies are born, don't we, at least in the big sense, have a moral responsibility to take care of them?
No.
No, I believe we do.
Well, of course.
The ones that are truly needy. Now, let's clarify that. But a lot of those conservatives say, oh, no, not me. Oh, no, no, no. Especially that child over here that's a minority. Yeah. That's not my responsibility. Let them take care of their own.
1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. How many people have heard the name Josh Seder? Josh Seder. Josh made the news recently when he had a couple of too many beers. It was kind of late, and he had the bladder all full and said, hey, there's a reservoir. I think I need to see water. Got to go. And he trickled down into the water there in Portland, Oregon. Turns out the water that he trickled down into was treated water that was going to be the drinking water for the people of Portland. It was an open-air reservoir. That water was going to go directly to the things that people turn on, the spigots in their kitchen. So what happened is they had to drain the entire reservoir, which, again, I'm kind of thinking that's kind of dumb, but I guess, you know, if you got a headline that someone took a leak in your drinking water, just to make, you know, kind of people feel a little bit better, maybe, but can you imagine what else is in there? But, you know, what they're saying is now this is kind of highlighting the sensitive nature of our drinking water supply, and we need to maybe spend some Homeland Security money to put up fences and security cameras and have people patrol and do all kinds of stuff to make sure that our water is secure, put big bubbles over it and all this other stuff. And I keep going to this whole idea. One, if the terrorists didn't think of this, now you've kind of told them, hey, our water supply is unprotected. Go on. Throw some ricin in there. Throw some stuff in there. It's A-OK. This guy, he just stood over and took a leak. But he got caught. Whole different scenario. But they, you know, they would, and what gets me is that, look, we've become such a society of scaredy cats. I mean, scared to death of our own shadow, it seems like. That, you know, oh, gee, you know, this could happen. Yeah, you know, a lot of things could happen. I could step off the curb tomorrow, get hit by a bus. And then we see all of this weird stuff. But with our water supply, why would you put this out in the media and say, oh, well, you know, this guy took a leak in there. Do we really need to know that? Maybe we should tell them that birds defecate in the water.
How about dogs?
Maybe we should tell them that there are fish in there. Maybe we should tell them that animals wash their behinds there as well. You know, maybe just a thought.
Sorry.
I don't, you know, but this whole thing just kind of makes me giggle. I don't know. Anyway, today, I don't know if you saw the reports, the Sierra Club is saying that the Commonwealth is leasing land in public parks and forests that the gas drillers, gas drillers are drilling on, and that it's really not in compliance with federal conservation laws. The Sierra Club, along with its Pennsylvania chapter, have written a letter. They've written a letter to the National Park Service and the state agencies responsible for approving the Marcellus Shale drilling sites on land protected by the National Conservation Act. Evidently, the Sierra Club has found 19 protected state parks within the Marcellus Shale drilling region, and they claim that Pennsylvania has already started leasing some 700,000 acres of this state forest for gas drilling. Again, we're doing things, and I've been saying this for the longest time, we're doing things before we know what we're doing. We're leasing all this land. We have no idea what it's going to do. But you know what? In Portland, Oregon, they drained an entire reservoir because one guy went wee wee. We don't seem to have a problem with people sticking in a needle full of toxic chemicals miles underground, sucking it all back out and dumping it right into the water. But you know, one guy went wee-wee, and that's the end of civilization. We're right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK.
Oh, con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
One person was giddy with excitement upon hearing President Obama's announcement that all of America's combat troops would depart from Afghanistan by 2014. Hamid Karzai. A moment of happiness for Afghanistan, exalted the incurably corrupt, inept, weak, and pompous Afghan president. Our leaders put this ingrate in power, and the lives of our soldiers and billions of our tax dollars have been spent to prop up his sorry excuse for a government, yet he's the one saying, good riddance. It puts the dumb in dumbfounding. The dumbest and most shameful aspect of America's 10-year Afghan war is the pretension that Karzai represents some flowering of democracy. Nonsense. Installed in the presidency by dictate of the Bush-Cheney regime in 2002, he's widely despised and ridiculed by Afghans and has clung to power through fraud and autocratic power plays. For example, in last year's parliamentary contest, Karzai was PO'd that 62 candidates he favored lost or were disqualified by the country's Independent Election Commission because of fraud. So, Hamid haughtily set up his own special court to review those results. The day after Obama's withdrawal announcement, Karzai's kangaroo court disqualified the 62 parliamentary winners, replacing them with his chosen ones. Of course, the 62 winners are refusing to budge from their seats, which has created a governmental stalemate. But this suits Karzai perfectly, for the stalemate allows him to rule without parliament. As the top opposition leader puts it, Karzai does not believe in the rule of law. He thinks democracy doesn't work in his favor. This is Jim Hightower saying, it's both insane and immoral for our leaders to cause even one more American to die for Karzai. Tell Obama to bring all of our troops home pronto. The White House comment line is 202-456-1111.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. You know, and talking about this whole scaredy cat thing, you know, you look at the TSA stuff, you know, people going through the, you know, the porno scanners or the strip search, which, you know, I'm not against, you know, though. What they should do is it should be, you know, for guys, you should have the option of it being a woman or a man, you know, depending on your preference, and make some fun out of it. But, you know, here's my problem now. Now they're saying, so now here's the thing. They wanted to, you know, they want to pat you down. They want to feel you up. In fact, one black woman was all upset. You know, maybe it was racial discrimination that they wanted to feel in her hair since she had a big thing going on there. Which, you know, hey, if you're going to feel the crotch of a 6-year-old child, your hair is not off limits. But here's the thing. Maybe all of this is now moot. Maybe this whole pat down strip search, maybe it's all moot. Maybe we have to go to, actual internal exams. Because if you saw this story at Reuters yesterday, militants are showing renewed interest in using a bomb surgically implanted inside a passenger's body to blow up a commercial flight. Now, here's the thing. The U.S. security official says there are no indications of an attack being imminent. So then why bring it up? Why do we have to talk about this now? And this is what gets me. It's just nuts. They throw out these things and see what sticks. Look, you know, every time I get on a plane, honestly, I mean, I'm worried that it's not going to land the way it's supposed to, on the runway with all its wheels. I worry it's going to crash. Now I got to worry about somebody who's now had a bomb surgically implanted in them. Like I said before, everyone should fly naked. That would just make life so much easier. But even that's now not going to work. Because they're saying surgically implanted. So now anybody with a scar, I've got to be afraid of people with scars now? You know, that thing on your neck, Jake, that's a scar. I think Habib put a bomb in your neck. Not that the ice cream's doing you any good. But, you know, it's just nuts. And, you know, and we got people who are really scared about this. Oh, you know, really? They're putting bombs in people.
Well, it's hard for me to believe that Al-Qaeda probably has thought about that.
Of course they have. You know, but how many people are you going to be able to sip up and say, okay, now get on the plane? That's a long process. The scar's got to heal, and you hope it doesn't blow up while they're healing. I don't know. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Tim Pawlenty's presidential campaign hit a little bump. Their co-chairman had to apologize. And again, I'm not getting why. Let me read the quote that got him into such trouble. His name's Vin Weber. He's a former Minnesota congressman. Yesterday, late in the day, he issued an apology, and this is what he said. He was talking about Michelle Bachmann. He said, she's got hometown appeal. She's got ideological appeal. And I hate to say it, but she's got a little sex appeal, too. And for that, he had to apologize. And I'm going,
for telling the truth?
Exactly. What is it that you're apologizing for? She's hot. Crazy hot.
I believe she's 55, right?
Yeah, she's for 55,
she
man.
Looks awfully good for 55. I mean, give her credit.
I'm not seeing what you have to apologize for. The part that, you know, I would have added crazy in there. Yeah. So if I were him, would I have had to then apologize for crazy? Or is crazy okay?
Now, here's the thing. If he would have been truthful and said, well, she's on in history, she's a little intellectually challenged, that would have been the truth, and he probably would have owed her an apology on that one, even though he was telling the truth. But to say that she's, sexually sexy or whatever he said.
She's got sex appeal.
Sex appeal, she's sexy, same thing.
Here's the statement.
That's an accurate statement.
Here's the statement. I made a mistake. That was disrespectful to my friend, Congresswoman Bachmann. I've been a Bachmann supporter in her congressional bids, and I apologize. I was not speaking on behalf of Governor Pawlenty's campaign, but nevertheless, it was inappropriate, and I'm sorry. I'm sorry for being a man. Well, okay, I guess we've now gone right back to the beginning. Wow, scary, scary stuff. And look, you know, if that's how it's become in the Republican Party now, that you've got to apologize for saying that, you know, hey, she's easy on the eyes.
You got to remember, she's still in Congress, and he's involved, and if he probably might want a job sometime or a favor, and that's what, you know, he's a Republican and they take care of their own. However, you got to be a loyal, for lack of a better word, a loyal subject to the Republican cause.
Well, the reality is, if she were butt ugly, she wouldn't be Tea Party Queen. She would not be. She'd be one of those people, honey, can you get us some coffee?
I mean, on a certain level, I can understand the attraction. She's just full of energy. Just
she is.
Full of energy. Oh. And then she talks. and then all those, the illusion of being a good candidate in my mind disappears.
You know, for me, it's the eyes. You can see it in the eyes. There's just full of crazy in there. And I guess that's.
But her latest guffaw was scary. When she started talking about how, well, it won't be all that bad if we don't, you know, lift the dead ceiling, you know, as if it's just a walk in the park. Well, that's just not true. And this lady wants to be president? Oh, my. Now, that truly is scary.
Well, what bothers me is this. I mean, to be honest, this bothers me.
You know, what's marvelous is that in this country and under our Constitution, we have the ability, when we recognize that something is wrong, to change it. And that's what we did in our country. We changed it. We no longer have slavery. That's a good thing. And what our Constitution has done for our nation is to give us the basis of freedom unparalleled in the rest of the world.
Even though she's a Tea Party, arguing the original intent on both sides of the issue, and arguing that John Quincy Adams was a father, founding father. Yes, he was right there. He brought his father, look, Daddy, drawings. Oh, nuts. Anyway, some more information on Clarence Thomas coming out. It's the more I read about this, the more our boy Clarence, he's got himself in a little trouble. There has been a Freedom of Information Act request filed in an attempt to determine whether our good friend there, the justice, has improperly disclosed the use of a private jet and a private yacht. Common Cause. They're the folks who have sought U.S. Marshal Service records, you know, to say, look, hey, where'd our boy go? You know, what's the deal here? The group said the request is aimed at determining whether Justice Thomas traveled on a plane owned by developer and political activist Harlan Crow on several occasions over the past 4 years, and if so, whether those trips were properly disclosed. The reality is there's some reports that saying that this Harlan Crow guy has given him, Clarence Thomas, a nice tidy sum worth of gifts over the past several years. You know, $15,000 bust of Abraham Lincoln and a whole bunch of other gifts. And, you know, I got to be honest, I didn't know you were able to do that to a Supreme Court justice, and I thought there was some ethics there. So it's going to be interesting as more and more people are coming around to this saying, you know, exactly what did Clarence do and when did he do it? And how much money did they give his wife? And I know Breyer has come out and said, well, you know, our wives do different things. I'm thinking there's a different dynamic there. I'm really thinking there's something very, very different there. But that's a whole different scenario. You know, and going back to the whole idea of, and Clarence Thomas is the one people taking us to conservative world. A lot of the decisions that have come down, that are pushing us into the world, into the realm of insanity, he's responsible for. So I look at this case in Auburn, Washington, where this 28-year-old construction worker went to cash a check, the home rebate check he got from the IRS, because, you know, he bought a house and he got a rebate check for it, went to take it to Chase Bank, and they evidently believed that it was a forgery, had this guy thrown in jail. He lost his house, he lost his car, he lost his job, and he ended up spending some time in jail. They've never apologized for it. They've never done anything, and it's been over a year now that this guy's lost his job and all of this because of this one incident. And this is why you need lawyers. Felix Luna, a Seattle lawyer there, is offering to help because, you know, he says, like the guy says, it's one thing to make a mistake. It's completely something else to make multiple errors of judgment like Chase has made. And then once you realize your error has caused such harm to somebody, to just ignore it. And, you know, this is the banking world, man. They have certainly taken to ignoring their customers. And in this case, actually throwing somebody in jail. I mean, think about that. How'd you like to go to the bank and say, Jake, Mr. Long, I think this is a forged check. You're going to jail. And you spend the weekend in jail, they tow your car, you lose your job.
Wow.
Very, very nice. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with our friend Kenton Bezanet from Talk Radio News Service. Right back after this.
Provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
That old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
I got
welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., Ken Bezanet, Talk Radio News Service. Ken, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, how are you tonight, sir?
What's going on in the big city?
Well, as you know, the eight leaders of the House and Senate, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, met with President Bush today. Oh, geez, President Obama today. That was a bad sign.
Might as well be.
Yeah. Why, ooh. It suddenly became Freudian. When Boehner returned to the Hill, he started to make some phone calls to rank-and-file members and committee chairmen, a couple of whom are very good sources of mine. And it turns out he is now telling his membership that there's a 50-50 chance of a deal here. Now, that sounds like it's, you know, not great odds, obviously, but compared to the fact that a couple of days ago it was zero.
Right.
That's changed. Now, you and I both know why Boehner is whistling a different tune here. Overnight, it turns out the president has floated the idea of tinkering with Social Security, Medicare on top of Medicaid, which they floated that idea over the weekend. And it's gotten some people up in arms on the left. Bernie Sanders has put out a statement right away saying the president is, you know, potentially going to go back on his word, that he wouldn't mess with Social Security. So, interestingly enough, the president now has to make a case to moderate Republicans, the American people, and members of his own party. So while John Boehner's a little more comfortable with this, the president may have a little bit more work on his hands.
No, all I got to say is he better hope that the Republicans are successful on the state level to deny senior citizens the right to vote through all of this photo ID stuff, because I think in November this is his undoing.
Well, you are obviously not alone in that. The devil's in the details. As I understand it, it's going to involve moving around cost of living adjustments and not for everyone. This may be the beginning of the means testing formula that a lot of people think we're going in the direction of ultimately, whether you or I like that or not. There are some people on the top rung who may have paid into Social Security their whole lives and may not get it.
As much of it. And there's discussion to be had about that. But the fact that we've now put Social Security on the table, to me, is a major, major capitulation.
Right. The good news is technically it's not on the table until the Republicans put up approximately $400 billion worth of tax loopholes and write-offs for corporations. The Republicans are trying to muddle the whole message by talking about next year's Bush tax cut renewal period, which comes up in next December, as you know.
Right.
But that's really not a part of this. Very doubtful, obviously, that those will be renewed again. But there's a little bit of confusion here and there on this, and that's the bottom line, I think, you know.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I listen to Warren Buffett, and I think this is a situation where we don't seem to have many adults in the room, because you got people who are taking these stances. I think Social Security is the third rail. I just, you know, the fact that we can't talk about raising taxes on the wealthiest people who've done so well, just blows my mind, Ken.
Yeah, I cannot. I'm trying to stay objective in this whole thing.
No, I hear you.
But I can't dispute a lot of what you're saying. And I think that the president's going to have his hands full on this one, and I hope he knows what he's doing. Hey, listen, can I give you something I think will make you feel a little better?
Hit me.
He did have a wake-up call on the whole housing crisis, as you know. He finally took a long, hard look in the rearview mirror. You know, and the alarm went off and someone was on the phone at the same time telling them, hey, you expected the banks to voluntarily give unemployed people a longer grace period on mortgage payments? Were you out of your mind?
Yeah.
Nope. So today the FHA, Federal Housing Authority, mandated that their loans and a couple other programs loans that, you know, that basically federally insured loans, not all, but many, If that's your note, you're actually going to get 12 months now if you're unemployed.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
That's a big deal.
But it's a big deal after the fact. Now I'm going to be the negative one. I think the president has given a big wet kiss to investment banks, Wall Street, and lenders. He came out tough, and the fact of the matter is he hasn't done much in terms of enforcement and crackdown, and there's been an awful lot of, even though he doesn't use the same words that Bush, President George W. Bush used in terms of the market will fix itself and the market will straighten itself out. The President, President Obama has at times taken kind of a laissez-faire approach to, you know, these banks and everything. So I think he admitted yesterday during that Twitter town hall that he could have done more. And today, wasting no time, the FHA came out with that announcement. So for our unemployed brothers and sisters who are holding, you know, their mortgages and wondering about their futures, they get a little bit more time here, and that's good.
That should be helpful for the folks who haven't been harmed already. So that that's a good thing. Speaking of the Twitter thing, I guess not happy at first, kind of came around, what?
Oh, amazing. But if I could just one little minor pat on the back, I broke that story this morning that just a few months ago, the president was whining and complaining about how anti-intellectual and how, you know, absurd the notion of Twitter and 140 characters, you know, and he didn't understand how it was catching on and everything. But what was really irking him, well, and he was telling this, you know, to his aides and to friends, and among those two groups are my sources on this story, basically, you know, saying what really irked him was the fact that Sarah Palin would tweet something and people of my ilk, you know, White House correspondents and political writers, would jump all over that and do a whole story off of what Sarah had just tweeted.
Yep.
And he felt that she was, you know, able to tweet something and we didn't talk to her directly, and it kind of annoyed him and that sort of thing. But all things being equal, I think he took a long, hard look at some of the success his own aides have had, Democrats have had, John Boehner has had, for instance. Bernie Sanders is great on Twitter. You know, he gets his message out that way. And I think the president sort of, you know, he had a, you know, a real come-to-Jesus moment, if you will, and on Twitter, and definitely is, you know, that was the result. Yesterday's town hall was the result. Now, ironically, people tweeted, you know, 140-character questions to him, and he responded in 140-paragraph answers.
Exactly. I was just going to say that. I go, you know, I don't expect to see him doing much tweeting here in the future because I don't think that he's, you know, he's brief enough. You know, and again, you know, I've got some problems with the 140 thing as well. You know, but
great for headlines though.
Yes, absolutely.
You know what I mean? But yeah, it's. I've tried to make an argument before on Twitter. You know what I mean? Even like when I'm sober. You know, where you know, okay, here's one thought, here's the rest of it, and then you look at it and you see, wow. This whole damn thing is like 10, 15, depending on who you're following, how many people you're following. My argument is now strewn among 10 or 15 different thoughts here.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it doesn't really work that way. But for headlines and for bumping out copy,
yep,
and that sort of thing.
It's beautiful.
I think for your medium, my medium, I think it's a tool
and
that
for
we
making,
can't avoid.
And for making snarky little comments, it's, you know, it's a good thing.
Yeah, exactly. I'll tell you what, if you go back and look at Basmanian Devil, that's my Twitter handle. Man, I picked one hell of a fight with the country of Canada over the Stanley Cup Finals, let me tell you.
Good for you, Ken. I'll let you get back to what it is that you do. I appreciate your time, brother.
Same here. Have a great night.
All righty. Ken Bazinet, Talk Radio News Service. And what do you got for us tonight, Jake?
Thanks, Rick. Story coming out of the Harrisburg Patriot concerning a man by the name of John Mackey. I don't know if you remember him, Rick, but he's a great football player. I remember him. Played for the Baltimore Colts. He played for the Colts from 63 to 71. They actually won a Super Bowl in 71 when they beat the Dallas Cowboys. He ended up his career in San Diego. He actually had a very good career, had over total over 5,300 yards reception and 38 touchdowns. But Mackey's efforts after his playing days were just as important as his performance on the field. An NFL labor agreement ratified in 2006 included the 88 plan. Now, the reason this is important, it was named after Mackey's number 88. It provided up to $88,000 a year for nursing care or daycare for ex-players with dementia or Alzheimer's disease, or $50,000 for home care. John Mackey is still our leader. As president of the NFLPA, he led the fight for fairness with a brilliance and with ferocious drive, according to Union Executive Director Damaris Smith. His passion continues to define our organization and inspire our players. His unwavering loyalty to our mission and his exemplary courage will never be forgotten. The health care of former players has become a prominent issue in the negotiations for a new collective bargaining agreement. An NFL lockout has been going on since March, and I think that's something that we don't talk a lot about. Former professional athletes, especially football players, for a long, long time were taken care of, and guys, great labor leaders, and he was a great football player. Apparently he was an equally great union leader, has looked out for those players, and this is an ongoing issue in the strike, and it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that as far as taking care of those who really made the game. And at the end of the day, and I know people say, well, why would you worry about NFL players? They make a lot of money. Well, some of them make big money, but there's a lot of players that only played a few years, didn't make all that much and got hurt. Or a lot of them had long careers, and at the time they played, they didn't have much of a retirement, and they really lived tough lives. And because of the efforts of people like John Mackey, they were taken care of, and that's a great thing to see. So, you know, God rest his soul. I salute John Mackey. He truly was a great man. Government reformers, a call for Pennsylvania citizens to refocus on a call for reform. Yesterday, they had a small rally. There was a band of citizen activists that stepped up to the plate in 2005 to help wake up the masses over what they considered to be an unjust and illegal pay raise law that the legislators passed. That 16% to 54% pay raise for lawmakers and executive branch officials was repealed 4 months later, but during those 4 months, 131 House members and 26 senators received between $1,288 to $14,500 from the higher paying levels that the law provided. 6 years later, the activists say, according to them, citizens are still incurring an annual bill as a result of that pay raise. They held a Capitol Rotunda news conference to discuss the ongoing fallout from this six-year-old action. In a report issued by Rock the Capitol, the group's co-founder, Eric Epstein, said 52 House members and 8 senators, past and present, who took the pay raise and didn't pay it back, continue to benefit from the short-lived pay raise. The lingering cost of the pay raise wasn't the only thing in their minds. Tim Potts, co-founder of the Democracy Rising, noted that the state attorney general's office investigation into the use of taxpayer funds for political purposes, dubbed Bonusgate, has lingered along 4.5 years. Only a handful of legislators have been charged in the House, and in the Senate, nothing at all has occurred. What makes this important, he said, is a statute of limitations on theft charges, like the ones filed against those who have been charged. Having a 5-year statute of limitations, an attempt to get a confirmation on that from the Attorney General's office was unsuccessful at the time of this post. So without any further prosecution, sometime in November, those in the General Assembly who may be guilty of crimes will simply laugh all the way to the bank. And that's something that I haven't considered, Rick. The one trial that we talked about last night, the Gene Orry trial, the irony is, it involves illegal use of public funds for political purposes, but those charges were brought by the district attorney out in Allegheny County. So, you know, stay tuned on that one. Sick leave, we talk about this from time to time. Some states and some cities have attempted to pass paid sick leave legislation. Apparently, Connecticut has become the first state in the nation to have a law requiring employers to provide paid sick leave, and efforts to pass similar legislation are underway in several cities and states, including Denver, Seattle, New York City, Massachusetts, and Georgia. Only two cities in the nation, San Francisco and Washington, D.C., have paid sick leave on the books. Meanwhile, in Seattle, the city council is considering a bill that will require businesses to provide workers in Seattle up to 5, 7, or 9 days of paid sick leave a year, depending on the size of business and the number of hours worked. According to the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, it reports that McKenna Howe, who runs the small vegan eateries Hillside Quickie and Plum Bistro, with some 30 employees, said in a hearing on the bill that she supports the legislation because she doesn't want her employees handing food while sick. This is what she said. I thought this was great. All of us get sick. I can't afford losing employees, and I don't want to serve H1N1 with your fries. If we can do it, meaning small business can do it, big business can do it as well. And I say,
light bulb.
The new law allows each employee in a business with 50 or more employees to earn 1 hour of sick pay for every 40 hours work, with the number of days capped at 5 per year. This is good news. I mean, this issue continues to gain momentum nationwide, and it's about time. We talked about the workers and workers packing the hearing and the NLRB ruling. That was kind of a sham hearing where most of those who testified were anti. There was one individual who testified for workers. His name was Kenneth Dahl Schmidt, a professor of labor and management law at Indiana University. He told the House Education Workforce Committee it's time to update the NLRB's election process. Although Dahl Schmidt was the only witness at the hearing to support the NLRB's proposed new rule designed to ensure a fair process for workers who want to vote or whether to form a union, the proposed rule has drawn strong support. He told the committee that the board's election procedure is broken and needs an overhaul. Too many cases, he said, unscrupulous employers and the union avoidance firm, the employee used the NLRB process to intentionally delay the election and give them time to intimidate employees into voting against the union through illegal, unfair labor practices. He said the many opportunities for delay invite lawlessness and undermine the integrity of the election process. Pointed out the process has become so cumbersome and subject to employer manipulation that many unions have abandoned formal NLRB elections in favor of employer voluntary recognition. And in fact, under Bush, quite a few internationals totally avoided the inept and ineffective NLRB. So it's very much time for NLRB to improve their process.
Tomorrow we will have Ken Dahl Schmidt here on the program. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around.
To the Rick Smith Show.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began their first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, loyal only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized a renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Official supporter of Palin Santorum 2012, The Rick Smith Show.
show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, we've got it archived at our site at thericksmithshow.com. It's there for your convenience, your entertainment. If you got any questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. We do answer all questions personally. So there you go. I want to thank all of our guests, Scott Kies from Think Progress, talking about the Republicans, you know, thinking about impeaching Obama over the debt ceiling that they're holding the country hostage with. Really? Have we fallen that far down the rabbit hole? Perhaps. Also, our good friend, Professor John Logan from San Francisco State on the NLRB and all of the shenanigans that went on tomorrow, of course. We're going to talk with Kenneth Schmidt, one of the guys who testified, the only guy who testified on the side of workers in the NLRB, the hearing today in Congress. So that was, well, that'll be interesting. And Deanne McQueen, vice president of the National Nurses United Union. It was good talking to her about Social Security and the whole thing there. Again, you know, I'm of the mindset that right now, and I'm hoping I'm wrong, hoping I'm dead wrong on this, that the president has blinked, that this whole thing is, even the sheer fact that we're putting Social Security on the table to me seems to be a huge step in the wrong direction. Like I said, hope I'm wrong. Hope I am wrong. Big story also this week, ExxonMobil, another spill. They're estimating, you know, I wonder what the EPA is going to say, but they're estimating that 1,000 barrels of oil spilled into the river there at Yellowstone National Park, screwing everything up there. People are complaining that they can't breathe. Folks are complaining that the fumes are you know, making them sick, making them dizzy, causing shortness of breath. Health officials are saying, well, you know, that stuff, when it dissipates, you know, it'll all be fine. Don't worry about it. They're taking samples, I guess, the oil company and the EPA. So it'll be interesting. What I found funny, though, is the company said, well, you know, at the most, it's like my children. You know, anytime the kids get caught doing something, it's always minimized. You know, they're good at that. I think we all do it. The company said, you know, oh, no, the spill lasted no more. At most 30 minutes, at most. DOT records right now are showing that 56 minutes. So almost double, but, you know, at most 30. And, you know, it was kind of like the whole thing in the Gulf. Well, it's just a little spill. Don't worry about it. No, don't pay attention. Just a little bit. So it'll be interesting to see how we, and again, you know, you stop and you think about this right through the national park. Did you know there was this going on? I didn't. And did you know that here in Pennsylvania, through our state parks, we've leased a whole bunch of land for people to stick needles in the ground? Most people didn't. A couple of quick stories before we wrap up for the night. Kind of a funny thing in Virginia. Turns out that U.S. Army Captain Little Jim, his name is Little Jim, got drunk one day. Justin Dale Little Jim is his name. Got drunk about 2:45 in the morning. Decided that, you know, he was a little excited, you know, needed a little company. So he broke into one of those adult bookstore kind of things where they sell, you know, videos and adult marital aids. Well, when he broke in, you know, he decided he wanted a little companionship. So they found him in some little, I guess, storage closet or some little stall, attempting to have relations with a blow-up doll. Yeah, he was charged with burglary, grand larceny, and destruction of property. I'm not sure if the destruction of property was the blow-up doll or what, but he's being held $5,000 bond. So locked up in the Prince William County slammer there. I wonder how his buddies back in the Army are going to take that. I wonder how, if he's ever going to live that down.
I'm sure they won't mention it.
And for all you pet owners, there's an apartment complex in Massachusetts that might, in New Hampshire. It is in Nashua. It's Twin Ponds in Nashua, New Hampshire, that evidently, when you move in, and if you have a pet, they want DNA samples of your pet. You'll love this. They take DNA samples of all of your pets, and you have to, you know, leave a sample of their droppings. Because evidently this apartment complex doesn't want people walking their dogs and leaving little droppings all around. So they keep a sample on record so that when they find a little pile, they can have it tested. And they find out who it is, and they go after who it is, and then you're busted. So again, you know, it's not bad enough that we're putting cameras everywhere. It's not bad enough that when we go to the airport, it's strip search time and you know, porno scanners. Now your dog can't even go to the bathroom without somebody taking its butt print. Amazing, amazing stuff. Anyway, I want to thank everyone tonight who came on the program. I want to thank you for listening, our callers. Thank you. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, rick@therickssmithshow.com. It is there for your convenience. We appreciate any feedback, thoughts, comments, questions, all of that. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Again, tomorrow we'll be back here, same time. Kenneth Schmidt. Going to talk about the NLRB thing. We're going to have somebody. It is our Future Friday, so we'll have our guests from the Campaign for America's Future. We hope you'll join us tomorrow, 9 to midnight. We'll see you tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickssmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous rain. Democracy is coming to the
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.